rubbish.
But not obliged.
Not obliged.
Anyhow, I prefer not to be alone.
But you're not obrigado.
Not obrigado.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tony Giddens, the director of the LSE, at least for a little while longer, and it's my great pleasure to welcome everyone to this event here this afternoon. These two panels which we're having are being held to mark the halfway point in the LSE £100 million fundraising campaign. We're only halfway through this campaign, but I'm very pleased to say that we're a long way, more than halfway through in terms of raising the money. It's a great achievement in the background of the world economic climate which we're going to discuss today to have done this. So I'd like to thank Mary Blair, the head of the development officer here, and her colleagues, and Fiona Hodgson, the head of the New York development office, for all the work not only they put into this event, but in their marvelous achievement in getting us so far ahead in this fundraising campaign. I'm very pleased to be sharing the chairing of this event with Paul Volcker. The LSE is not designed for people of Paul Volcker's size, so he's trying to get his knees under the table, but it's a bit difficult for him. Paul has been really a great friend to me in the school over the last few years, and again I'd like to thank him publicly on this occasion. He himself is a major donor to the school. This is the third such event that we've chaired together. We had one in New York, we had one in Washington a little time ago. Paul also has served as the honorary chair of the New York campaign for the LSE. So he's been a major influence on this whole campaign. For a certain while, Paul Volcker was the world economy, so he's a very good person to coach this event. Before introducing our panelists, I'd just like to point out that these two panel sessions are very closely related. The reason being that if we can't produce some kind of resurgence in the world economy, there's very little chance of meeting the United Nations ambition of halving world poverty by 2015. We only know one way, so far as I know, of leveraging millions of people out of poverty, and that is economic development in which poor people participate. So we see these two sessions as very closely related. And we have got amazingly distinguished people to discuss them for you. So why there are empty seats down the front, I can't imagine. I think we should be scouring the streets for interested students to put in here, because we've got such a wonderful collection of people to speak to you today. Each person is going to speak strictly for 5 to 6 minutes and will be cut off thereafter. There'll be a bit of interchange between the panel and Paul after the first session, and then open discussion from the audience. We have until 4:30 for this session, and there's a half an hour break between the two. Can I very, very briefly introduce the panelists? I'll introduce them in alphabetical order, and they will speak in alphabetical order. First, Professor Charlie Bean, sitting at the far end there, a longtime colleague of mine in the LSE, and now Chief Economist and Executive Director of the Bank of England. And I'd also like to thank Charlie for all the help he gave me on the APRC and other arcane committees in the LSE when we served on them together. Next along, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, the ex-president of Brazil, and the most distinguished sociologist ever to achieve high political office. I knew Fernando Henrique when we were both itinerant sociologists wandering around the world, and it's amazing what he's achieved in his political career, and I'm very, very grateful for him for coming for this event, because he has come specifically for this event today and the dinner this evening. Next along, Howard Davis, who, if he isn't familiar to you in an LSE context, will be very familiar soon. Howard is the chairman of the Financial Services Authority and the incoming director of the LSE, so you've got to treat him very nicely. Next along, we have Mikiko Fujiwara, one away from me, two away from me, who is going to speak about Japan, who is a visiting fellow at the Research Institute of Economy, Trade and Industry in Japan, very distinguished investment banker as well as economic analyst. Finally, we have Professor Hyun Shin from the LSE. Again, I'd like to thank you, Hyun, for all the help you've given me during the time I've been here. He's one of the best citizens in the LSE, but also a remarkable intellectual in his own right. He is Professor of Finance in the London School of Economics. So I'm now effectively, I think, going to turn over to Paul, who is going to be the kind of dynamo running this first session, while I just sit and watch.
Well, thank you, Tony. I'm delighted to be here, but as an old central banker, my job is very simple. It's to be disciplinarian. These people are supposed to talk for 5 or 6 minutes. I asked whether we had an alarm clock. I was told no, but there's a clock up staring me in the face, which I will try to look at occasionally. My arm is not quite long enough to reach to Mr. Bean, but somehow I will scowl or something as you proceed too long. Let me just say I am delighted to be here. It's just over 50 years since I was a student at this place. I would have thought in the ensuing 50 years you might have gotten somewhat larger tables up here that I could get my legs under. I think this ought to be a priority of the second half of the campaign. I see you got more comfortable seats down there than you had 50 years ago.
We'll just try and get smaller alumni.
Yeah. I don't know. People are growing. Don't they learn that in sociology courses?
Some of us are getting smaller, you know.
I will cease. We have a variety of people to talk about this important issue of recession or revival. That puts it rather starkly from different perspectives from different parts of the world, different disciplines. I notice there's nobody from the United States to talk.
You.
That's occasionally thought to be important in terms
Paul
of
Paul is
going
to contribute to the discussion. This is the reason why there is no American actually on the panel.
I only like to criticize people, so we're going to have the panel go first. So Professor Bean, you've got your 6 minutes.
Thank you. Good afternoon. It's a great pleasure to be back here. Views of the world economy after the conclusion of hostilities in Iraq tend to fall into two camps, really. First, there are those who see the current economic cycle essentially as a normal one, but one in which recovery has been postponed by a series of adverse events, September 11th, corporate scandals, the war in Iraq, of course, and lately SARS. And second, there are those who see a more prolonged downturn as the excesses of the past reflected in stretched household and corporate balance sheets and external imbalances unwind, possibly leading to a period of deflation across large parts of the industrialized world. Now, which of these two views is likely to materialize? I put myself in the first camp, but recognize that the imbalances that have been built up could pose risks to the strength and sustainability of the recovery. So in central bank speak, which is the lingo I have to use these days, I'm a cautious optimist. Well, what are the reasons for feeling at least moderately cheerful? The oil price has fallen back by about $10 a barrel from its pre-war peak. Equities, which on most measures now seem fairly priced, are up around a quarter since their March lows. And more recently, longer-term interest rates have fallen. All of these should help to underpin demand in the industrialized countries going forward. In the real economy, there's been some post-Baghdad rebound in business and consumer confidence, particularly in the US and also in this country. And there's evidence that the capital overhang in the US from the late 90s investment boom has also been largely worked off. And finally, and importantly, monetary and fiscal policies are generally stimulative, especially so in the United States. So the conditions for recovery appear to be in place. Now, how could such a recovery be derailed? Firstly, the world economy is still very heavily reliant on the US consumers' willingness to keep spending. The household savings rate there remains at historically low levels, despite past falls in equity wealth, and the rise in unemployment. In part, the continued strength of consumption reflects the stimulative policy stance, but were consumers to turn bearish, it would have a significant effect on growth prospects, not only in the US, but the rest of the world. The second risk, I think, relates to the unravelling of current account imbalances and the associated movements in exchange rates. The euro has now recovered virtually all of the ground it lost during the first 2 years of monetary union, and the dollar has fallen back from the unsustainably high level of a year or so ago. Many, including we at the bank, had found it difficult to explain the strength of the dollar and had expected a correction at some point as part of the process of correcting the US current account deficit, which currently runs at around 5% of GDP. However, the movement in the dollar against currencies other than the euro has been limited as the Asian currencies have followed the dollar down. And as a result, the brunt of the exchange rate correction is going to be borne by the euro area. Now, growth in the euro area has been consistently disappointing during the global downturn. And what growth there has been attributable to the net foreign trade component rather than domestic demand. The loss in competitiveness from the appreciation of the euro will hold back this element of growth, so it's crucially important that domestic demand takes up the running going forward. Were this not to happen, and euro area unemployment to continue rising, then one might see heightened transatlantic tensions and a temptation to resort to protectionist measures. Preventing this, and indeed ensuring the Doha trade round is a success, seems to me one of the most important tasks facing politicians and policymakers. I want to conclude with a brief discussion of the possibility of deflation, about which there has been much recent commentary. Is it quite as much a spectre as it's made out to be? A classic deflationary spiral occurs when a lack of demand leads to falling prices. As a consequence, real interest rates rise, further depressing demand. And moreover, a falling price level redistributes wealth from debtors to creditors, and that's also likely to depress demand. The result can be a vicious spiral, which in the Great Depression led to US output falling by a third and prices by a quarter. More recently, Japan has been slipping in and out of relatively mild deflation, and some commentators believe that the US and other countries may go the same way. But I think it's important to realise that deflation is not an act of God, rather it reflects a failure of policy. The key feature of the nasty form of deflation is not that prices are falling per se, but rather that short-term nominal interest rates reach their natural lower bound of zero, so that conventional monetary policy becomes ineffective. But so-called unorthodox monetary measures, such as outright purchases of longer-dated bonds, equities, and foreign currency assets, are still available, as is fiscal policy. At this point, it's tempting to point out that Japanese fiscal policy has been stimulative during the 90s, and recently that the BOJ has indulged in such unorthodox monetary measures. But to me, the real lesson is that such measures need to be applied early to avoid getting into the mess in the first place. Recent comments by Chairman Greenspan and the Federal Open Market Committee have shown that the Federal Reserve is awake to this issue. Moreover, the Japanese case is characterized by a broken banking system, and I think in the US any similar problems would likely to be dealt with more rapidly. Finally, some commentators have also suggested that Germany could slip into deflation. But that seems to me a somewhat different case, as it makes little sense to talk about deflation within just part of a monetary union. Germany is still suffering from the after effects of unification and entered EMU with a somewhat overvalued exchange rate. In the absence of structural reform to reduce German labour costs, what we are seeing is simply the required adjustment in competitiveness occurring through differential inflation rates.
Well, thank you very much. You've almost made 6 minutes, and it was a very clear and concise explanation. You know, I'm not being mean about the 6 minutes. The object is to leave time for discussion. And unless we are disciplined at this point in the discussion, we won't leave enough time for discussion. Mr. President.
Well, thank you very much.
I think for my sake, we'll give every panelist a clap. So
<laughs> 20 seconds for clapping.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. First of all, let me stress how pleased I am to be able to participate in this well-deserved tribute to Professor Giddens and to the LSE. As to the subject of the panel, let me suggest that we put things into perspective. I'm not an economist. I have not the ability to do a precise analysis in financial terms. I would prefer to put into perspective and give due weight to the fact that the technological innovation has always been at the root of each and every economic cycle. It goes without saying the latest economic cycle, the information economy, in the words of Manuel Castells, is no exception to this rule. The breathtaking revolution in information technologies has been decisive for the shaping of current patterns of production, management, distribution, trade, and consumption. Had there not been the extraordinary advances we have borne witness to in the microelectronics, informatics, and telecommunications, not to mention the related discoveries in biotechnology, new materials, and renewable energy, the shape of the economy whose prospects we are now discussing would have been dramatically different. Developments such as the upsurge in productivity levels, globalization of investment, production and market policies, shift from standardized mass production to flexible, customized production, to mention some, would hardly have occurred in the absence of information technology. Neither would it be credible to speak, as we can do today, of the emergence of a global civil society which has direct impact on trade and consumption styles. The question we are now faced with is whether this stage of things is called into question by the economic downturns of the last years. Is that the case, or the technology information age is instead far from exhausting its potentialities? One might argue that we cannot have a clear answer to this question until the major blocks of economies put their house in order. In other words, unless the reform of the Japanese financial system progresses well, the U.S. economy is poised grow and doubts about the capacity of the German economy to withstand euro area interest rates are overcome, the sustainability of information economy cannot be put to a real test. In the meantime, we might be entitled to venture some general forecasts. First, it seems only fair to claim that whatever the future course of events is, it is rather likely that applied knowledge will continue to have an increasing role in the growth of productivity. Such a trend precedes the informational age and will certainly survive it. Hence the importance that the marriage of university, enterprise, and public authority is encouraged ever more. Allow me to recall the example of Brazil, a country which failed in the 80s to fully benefit from the latest world economic boom exactly because of the incapacity of public power to foster a national partnership in favor of the improvement of human capital and higher levels of productivity. The country has by now succeeded in modernizing the state structure so that it could steer a national strategy, as it is already doing, towards economic modernization and a closer and competitive integration with international trends. The creation and successful development of Mercosul was a crucial step in that direction, as it opened up new investments and market opportunities, including in information-related areas. Not to mention the fact that as an example of open regionalism, Mercosul has enhanced, rather than inhibited, links with other blocs. Here comes another point worth making about prospects for the world economy. It seems out of question that a new technological paradigm will dispense with the importance of an expanded and stable world market for profitability and productivity. This implies less protectionism and a more predictable financial environment, which in turn requires improvement in global governance. Objectives as such as the success of the WTO negotiations in the timing of a speculative assault on national currencies are of the utmost importance for the upturn of the world economy, be it in its current mold or in a different one. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Davies.
Thank you, Paul. I'm slightly nervous about speaking about the economy on a platform with Charlie Bean, because when the banking supervision part of the Bank of England was separated from the rest, you know, when we had our velvet divorce The governor and I agreed that in future he would say nothing about banking supervision, and I would say nothing about the real economy. And this has been the basis for an extremely successful relationship over the last 6 years. So what I will do is focus particularly on financial markets and what financial market developments might currently be telling us about the state of the world economy, and in that context to highlight some of the downside risks to the outlook, because I always think it's an appropriate role for a regulator to look for trouble. We are not meant to be cheerleaders, I think. I'm conscious as I do this that we have a kind of two-tier audience here, not just in the obvious physical sense, but that some people down below have got slides and some people up above have not. I guess the only explanation I can give for this lot must have been paying top-up fees already. But I will try and explain in a way that doesn't mean that those who haven't got the charts are not are too much disadvantaged. If we look first at what's been going on in equity markets, well, everybody knows that in 2002 equity market indices fell in very volatile market conditions, and new issuance more or less came to a full stop. As for why this happened, I think that investor nervousness and lack of equity appetite was attributable to a combination of factors: the uncertain outlook for the world economy, exacerbated by geopolitical uncertainty, the fragility of the US economy, but also, I think, importantly, corporate accounting scandals and scandals surrounding investment bank research contributed, I think, to low investor confidence. Since the end of the war, equity indices have picked up really quite sharply. The S&P has gained 24% as of last Friday, the FTSE 26%, and indeed the DAX 47%. That had, in fact, fallen more sharply, but that is quite a rapid pickup. And also, at the same time, volatility is sharply down. Both implied and historic 30-day volatility has averaged around 20%, down from peaks of 35% or even slightly more in the first quarter of this year. And it seems that this rally has been encouraged by swift resolution of the war, somewhat improved consumer confidence, rising corporate earnings in the first quarter in the US and elsewhere, and also the supportive effect of some new IPO issuance. If you look, however, at the debt market, then you can see that government bond prices have been going up for a lot longer, and yields have been falling really quite sharply. Yields fell very sharply last year, and bond prices rose at the time equity markets were falling, which illustrated a familiar flight to quality as people moved out of equities and into bonds. In late March, early April, there was a brief reversal as equities rallied following the start of military action in Iraq, but the trend has since resumed. And there is now a lively debate among analysts about whether government bond markets are now experiencing their own version of the equity market bubble. And there's clearly a risk that investors switching out of equities and into government bonds have artificially pushed up prices in the short term and could suffer significant losses if yields begin to move upwards. And according to some analysts' research models, government bonds currently look overvalued. Indeed, some estimates currently suggest the US 10-year yield at 3.34% is around a percentage point below the derived equilibrium. If you look at the corporate debt markets, until mid-March, spreads had been pretty stable but have narrowed very significantly since. Merrill Lynch Sterling Corporate Credit Spread Index went from 123 basis points to 100 basis points in the space of a couple of months. This seems to be driven by a combination of both fundamental and technical factors. On the fundamental side, if you like, there are some positive signs emerging from credit quality indicators. Defaults are sharply down. Corporate defaults in the first 4 months of 2002 were $52 billion. In the first 4 months of 2003 were only $16 billion. So there has definitely been an improvement in credit quality. But also there may be some technical factors behind this, as fixed income funds have seen very significant inflows. Again, the other side of the coin of people's nervousness about equities. And if you look at volumes in the primary markets, you can see some signs of a pickup, mainly so far in the bond markets, where global debt issuance has been rising and issuance in the first quarter of this year was considerably higher than in the last three quarters of last year, so far not that much in the equity market, although at the FSA we do see the equity market queue because of our role as a listing authority, and there are some indications that there are now people bringing or ready to bring transactions to the market. If we look at the currency markets very briefly, of course we know that the dollar has been on a downward trend since early 2002 against most major currencies, most notably against the euro, which is currently at around its all-time high. Partly, maybe, this has some policy dimension to it, as the new Treasury Secretary, John Snow, seemed to signal a shift away from a strong dollar policy. But it looks to us as if investors have been pulling money out of dollar-denominated assets, given deteriorating economic performance and the bear market in equities, concerns over corporate governance practices, historically low interest rates, and, of course, war uncertainties. But it's important to note that the decline in the dollar so far is still relatively modest compared with its earlier appreciation. From trough to peak, 95 to 2002, the Fed trade-weighted dollar index rose by about 35%, and it's declined by only about 10% since then. Given the general perception that the dollar looked overvalued in 2002, we think a moderate decline will probably have beneficial effects, and overall it's been quite orderly and gradual so far. But the depreciation against the euro and sterling will have only a limited impact on the US external balance, because trade with the eurozone and the UK is only about 20% of total US international trade, and export growth to the euro region will still be hampered by weak economic performance in the eurozone. So, trying to sum up the risks surrounding the outlook from this analysis, we would say overall that there are some broadly positive indicators about the near-term outlook in financial markets: the equity market rally, tightening bond spreads, and particularly, I think, signs that aggregate credit quality may well be improving. But we would still see a number of important risks on the horizon. Charlie has talked about deflation and given a reasonably optimistic reading about that. The only finesse I would put on what he said is that while I agree that deflation in Germany essentially is a eurozone problem, I think there is potentially more of a difficulty if you have a part of the eurozone where the quality of banks' balance sheets is particularly weak. And so I do not think we can completely write off some potentially destabilizing developments there. Consumer indebtedness remains a concern to us, both in the US and in the UK, and highly leveraged borrowers may not be taking account of their ability to service debt should their circumstances or interest rates change. We are nervous about a bond bubble, and that could be some serious risk of capital loss for investors who have piled into the bond market recently. And despite the forward-looking nature of financial markets, there is a risk that the rally in equity markets could be premature and might be something still of an overreaction to improved earnings data. So it is incumbent on me not to separate myself from the Bank of England's analysis. So Charlie said he was a cautious optimist. I will agree strongly with being cautious. If I've been too long, do not give me the clap. A clap.
Pretty close. It's an admirable panel so far. I've only got one criteria. Brevity. Please.
Good afternoon. I would like to make just 5 points. Firstly, in the Japanese case, there is no question whether there is a recession or recovery. There is still a deep recession. This goes well beyond a normal 2 or 3 year deep in the business cycle. There is a major structural problem which extends well beyond just the economy. To solve this structural problem requires major changes in Japanese politics and even in Japanese culture. Secondly, to achieve anything, the depths of the deflationary slump must be recognized. With the bursting of the bubble economy, Japanese real estate shed $7.5 trillion US dollar in value, slipping from $20 trillion US dollars in 1990 to $12.5 trillion US dollars in 2000. Similarly, aggregate value of Japanese stocks fell from $7.5 trillion US dollars in 1989 to $2.5 trillion US dollars in 2001, shedding US dollar $5 trillion. Together, assets worth US dollar $12.5 trillion, which is equivalent to 3 years GDP in Japan, have evaporated. The ongoing slump brought on by the bursting of the bubble should be recognized as the worst ever in Japan. Banks had loaned aggressively, taking land and stocks as collateral. As one might expect, they are now suffering massive losses. It is unrealistic to expect banks on their own to clean up the issue of non-performing loans, a legacy of past lending practice. Japan's land values have fallen by 600 to 700 billion US dollars every year since 1990. Assuming that a mere 10% of those amounts are non-performing loans, 60 to 70 billion dollar worth of bad asset are generated annually. Certainly, in many ways, the system worked brilliantly from the late 1940s until the late 80s. The basic point is that a whole range of vested interest habits and just people are created during these boom years. It is these people who are still in charge of Japan. They are far too old to take risks or change their habits. The average age of Koizumi's cabinet was 60.4 in 2001, while Blair's cabinet was 48 years old on average in 1997. In the banking sector, Mizuho Group board average age is 59, while Deutsche Bank's executive committee's average age is 49. Fourthly, by now the crisis is so deep that only the top political leadership has the power to implement the necessary reforms. But they are far too old and conservative to do so. For instance, the average age of the Crucial Tax Committee of the LDP is 80. These people call 50-year-old MPs young. The patron-client networks, which decide who occupies key jobs in government and the Diet, are dominated by elderly LDP politicians with decades of service in the LDP and the Diet. Meanwhile, the population is unevenly represented in parliament. The old, the small town, and rural voters are heavily overrepresented. This makes it very difficult for any government to be radical or to take risks. Fifthly, let me finish with just three ideas which should be implemented. One, banks. Massive infusion of public funds is, of course, essential, but it is pointless unless you remove the current generation of managers and implement a more feasible business model. Two, birth rate. The Japanese birth rate is declining, and the population is aging more quickly than in any other developed society. Radical changes to encourage a higher birth rate and reduce government spending on pensioners are essential. Three, privatization. there is a huge amount of very inefficient government sector services which will have to be privatized in order to reduce government debts and make the economy more efficient. I have no time to say anything else. Just these three policies I have mentioned require a great deal more courage from Japanese politicians than any of them have shown in the last 30 years.
I reserve some time for myself to refute these comments and the deleterious effects of old age. We've got a young professor here who can deal with a young society in Asia and bring that perspective. Professor Shin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It really is a great privilege to share the platform with such distinguished speakers. Perhaps what I could set the stage for my remarks by quoting something from Herbert Hoover's memoirs about the debates in the U.S. Following the 1929 crash and the subsequent slide into what we now know as the Great Depression. Is this okay, the positioning?
You hear?
Everyone
here. Okay.
A bit closer? He says, and I quote, two schools of thought quickly developed within our administration discussions. First was the leave-it-alone liquidationists, headed by Secretary of the Treasury Mellon, who felt that government must keep its hands off and let the slump liquidate itself. Mr. Mellon had only one formula, and then here Hoover quotes Andrew Mellon, liquidate labor, liquidate stocks, liquidate the farmers, liquidate real estate. It will purge the rottenness out of the system. People will work harder, live a more moral life, values will be adjusted, and enterprising people will pick up the wrecks from the less competent people. And then Hoover goes on to say, and he sort of adds here, Secretary Mellon was not hard-hearted. In fact, he was generous and sympathetic with all suffering. He felt that there would be less suffering if his course were pursued. The real trouble with him was that he insisted that this was just an ordinary boom slump and would not take the European situation seriously. And he, like the rest of us, underestimated the weakness in our banking system. Now, of course, it's all very easy to pour scorn on Andrew Mellon's views from today's vantage point. I think, when set against today's sensibilities, his prescription of liquidating everything seems rather cold-hearted, harsh, and unnecessarily destructive. Although I should add that for some commentators, when the topic moves on to Japan, they begin to sound very much like Andrew Mellon. But we won't have time to talk about that here. It's also worth remembering that Mellon's views were widely shared in his day. Similar views were expressed very forcibly, actually here, probably from this platform, by Hayek and Robbins, who were the leading lights of the Austrian school. And in fact, if you read Lionel Robbins' 1971 autobiography, there is this passage. He refers to his views in the 1930s debates and says, and I quote, "They were as unsuitable as denying blankets and stimulants to a drunk who has fallen into an icy pond on the grounds that his original problem was overheating. I shall always regard this aspect of my dispute with Keynes as the greatest mistake of my professional career." Now, contrast this with what's been happening after the bursting of our bubble. So this is the bubble that burst in the year 2000. Since early 2001, central banks have eased monetary policy, with the United States being the most aggressive here. And interest rates there have fallen from over 6% at the beginning of 2001 to 1.25% today. And on Wednesday, the Federal Reserve is widely expected to cut the Fed fund rates further. And if you look at the interest rate futures market, they've already priced in a 0.25% cut. And they're actually betting on a slight chance of a 0.5% cut as well. And that would mean that if there is a 0.5% cut, this would mean that the Fed fund rate would stand at a mere 0.75%. So it all seems clear cut. So policy was wrong in the 30s, we've learned our lessons, and we're fine today. Okay. Well, of course, nothing is so simple in economics. After the bubble burst, even as business investment plummeted following the burst in the year 2000, the gap in demand, and I think here it's especially true for the UK and the US, the gap in demand has been made up by strong consumption growth, fueled by a housing boom financed by a household debt, that looks increasingly like another bubble in the making. So So far from removing the imbalances in the economy, the aggressive easing of monetary policy has exacerbated some. The housing market seems an obvious example. The United States current account deficit is another. The recent sharp fall in the dollar, I think, is symptomatic of the low appetite for dollar assets by foreigners as they become increasingly reluctant to finance the U.S. current account deficit. The repercussions for the eurozone of the sharp rise in the euro is adding to their pain, especially in Germany. The current orthodoxy is that a slump in activity and the specter of deflation, and I think it may be a specter actually, may be staved off by active policy, especially monetary policy. In the US, as the Fed funds rate approaches zero, there's more and more talk about unorthodox monetary policy measures, such as buying long-dated treasury bonds. And this kind of talk was really unthinkable even a few years ago. So the worry here is that if the world economy fails to revive in time to the stimulation, the accumulating imbalances will then be unleashed with a vengeance, causing an even bigger slump than would have happened if the stimulation had not been applied in the first place. So let me give you an analogy. You're piloting an aircraft at the end of the runway, preparing to take off. So you start your engines, you start your run, but the aircraft is more sluggish than you imagined. So you apply the throttle further, and the aircraft gains speed, but still not enough to take off. And so you persist. But after a while, you can see the end of the runway coming up. So what do? Well, of course, now it's too late to stop and try again. You have to give it full throttle and just hope that you can clear the end of the runway. And I suppose to some, the Federal Reserve's meeting on Wednesday gives us some flavor of that. So it seems that we've come full circle. You know, we learned the lessons of the Great Depression. We vowed never to repeat the mistakes. But now we're finding that the alternatives are not without their problems either. So perhaps the received wisdom embodied in our macroeconomic models that we teach our students, and there are lots of long-suffering students here of mine, are not so robust after all. Now, as academics, we have the luxury of being able to show some humility when we prove wrong. But of course, for central bankers, they don't even have that luxury because, you know, they are the beacons that others navigate by. And maintaining the confidence of the consumers in the financial markets is not served by airing one's doubts publicly. So my sympathy is actually with the policymakers. They're doing a very difficult job, and they really deserve our support.
That's the kindest comment I've heard about policymakers from an academic in a long time. I think I just better quit. Let me just make a few very quick remarks to round this off from the perspective, one perspective of the United States, where I find myself in a lot of agreement with what's been said, but a certain degree of difference in emphasis. When I look at the American economy, I'm somewhat reminded of the comment, I don't remember whether it was Oscar Wilde or Groucho Marx, comment about Wagner's music, it's not as bad as it sounds. There's an awful lot of talk about the American economy, but it plugs along at a reasonable rate of speed. People forget we're not having much of a recovery, but we didn't have much of a recession. And, you know, there's some correlation between very small recessions and relatively slow recoveries. We have massive stimulus at work. We're well down the runway. There are no Andrew Mellons in Washington today except statues and museums. We have an amount of stimulus that is beyond anything I am familiar with in history. So the question is, while the economy isn't doing too badly, why isn't it doing better given all this stimulus? And I think it suggests that the takeoff is in a nice wet snowstorm, which kind of raises some risk as to whether you can reach the appropriate rate of speed. The snowstorm is there are big disequilibria in the economy. There remain big disequilibria in the economy that this mild recession and recovery have not done much to deal with, and that presents certain risks as we move ahead. We know we had a massive overinvestment financially and in real terms in the technology industry. We haven't quite lived through that yet, but we've got this record current account deficit. We are living off of the beneficence of strangers from a capital inflow. We've been living for a long time, and they may not be so eager to keep sending that money. In fact, the only reason we are getting a capital inflow now big enough to finance our current account deficit is that the Asian central banks are vigorously buying dollars to the point that they hold a very large fraction of our rising federal debt. I don't think we can indefinitely be so dependent upon, if not an unsustainable boom, certainly an unsustainable boomlet in the housing market. People are getting more leverage rather than less during a period when they're going through a decade of, by my conservative lights, being highly leveraged. So there are a lot of problems we have to work through to keep this economy going. Now we have this worry about deflation. Let me just be brief. If I was setting odds on a real deflation in the United States in percentage terms, it would not round as high as 1%. It would round out to zero. I see no prospect of a real deflation, and I don't mean it's not impossible for the consumer price index to decline for a year. That is not a deflation. I would say that is in the range of stability. When you talk about deflation, if you think about anything like what we had in the United States and other countries in the 1930s, I do not see that as a possibility. Prices are rising. We used to call 2 to 3% inflation back when I was a kid, inflation. We didn't call it stability. Now we've kind of redefined 2 or 3% inflation as stability, which I think is probably a mistake too. But we do have very vigorous stimulative policies. And let me suggest that this emphasis on deflation may carry too far, be a little unfortunate, because you can carry the stimulus to a point that carries risks of itself. At some point, if you have a reversal, the reversal in market psychology could be great enough to reverse a fairly weak recovery prematurely, or if you don't reverse it, you may find that inflation psychology and expectations begin arising. And we know how difficult it is to deal with those once they begin. So I think we have some real problems. I think the United States is doing okay in a cautiously optimistic way, given the problems that exist. But I think it is very difficult to feel comfortable from an American perspective when the rest of the world is doing so poorly. Because as I see it, it's not just a question of the United States pulling up the rest of the world. We need a little help from expansion in the rest of the world to deal with our own imbalances, including that very big trade and current account imbalance. So with that much, I'll let the panelists attack me or attack each other for a few minutes. Who wants to attack or comment or whatever?
Would you, Paul, would you... extend
you don't have to attack me, I might just...
No, but it's a convenient target. Pick on one of the 8-year-olds first, as Kike was having a go at you. Would you apply your very low probability of deflation to Germany as well as to the US?
No. Well, I think it's a very low probability and a real deflation, if you define inflation as... you know, at least noticeable decline in prices for several years. I think it's low, but not as low as in the United States. I think Germany is a real problem. Japan, I would hardly call it a deflation, but it's an interesting case where they have had enormous stimulus. People say they haven't done anything. They haven't done anything in what people think of as restructuring. But they had, I don't know, what is a government deficit running, what, 7, 8, 9% a year for years? And interest rates as low as you can get them. I mean, that's my definition of stimulus.
Well, during the 90s, Japanese government spent 130 trillion yen to stimulate Japanese economy. But what they learned from this Keynesian policy is that the money did not create growth in economy. And this is a kind of sort of mistake they cannot observe because they don't have alternatives. And is that something I'm answering you? When they put the money to stimulate the public works, that created the jobs and reduced possible increase in unemployment. But those people who got the money did not spend, and because they worried about their future. There is a big uncertainty of their jobs in the future. They prefer to save money instead of consuming it. And that was one of the big reasons of Japanese deflation. And still, they don't want to buy a house. They much prefer to save the money rather than spending the money. And this is a problem of Japanese economy right now.
May I make a very, very short comment? I think that what has just been said is basic, because we are discussing, of course, I think it's very important to understand more properly what will happen in the financial markets and if the dollar vis-a-vis the euro, so on and so forth. But there is behind a different kind of problem, and I think that the Japanese case illustrates quite well. Maybe as a sociologist, I would put more accent now, more stress, the lack of spirit of risk. People prefer not to risk. This is true in Japan, but it's also true in Germany. And if I look around my own region, Latin America, what makes the difference between Brazil and Argentina, for instance, is the fact that the Argentinians are not risking at all, because in Argentina there is a kind of lack of confidence in political men, in government, and in the future of the nation, if I can put it like that. This is just the opposite regarding the situation in Brazil. People believe that it's possible to do, even when the situation is very bad. Believe that it's possible to do. So let's try to invest, let's breathe. Behind maybe the demographic phenomenon has been said by you are very important, and they are very important indeed. Because in some situations, like in the Brazilian situation, we cannot risk not to do something. Because otherwise, the level of poverty and the social unrest will be immediately so high that it's necessary to take some risk and some measures. So to a large extent, for these countries, it's rather a socio-political problem than a financial problem. The financial problem just reflects what is behind. I don't know if from the wide world perspective, this is also true. But I would like to suggest that we have another problem, the lack of global governance, the lack of global institutions able to cope with new realities, even in financial aspect. When I was president, I suffered for five financial crises, five in 8 years. And the crisis came from abroad, and not necessarily because of the domestic situation, maybe to some extent. To some extent. But anyhow, if it is true that internally some fragility exists, it is also true that the fragility are over-exaggerated by external pressures, and there are no institutions to take care of that. So I think there is a political problem involved in the whole discussion about are we going or not toward a more stable recession. I hope not.
Let's just pick up on, I think there's an interesting point which follows on from that. I mean, it's a slightly different point, but very much in the same spirit, is that if you look at Japan and now more recently Germany, and I should emphasize, there are plenty of reasons why Germany is rather different from Japan. Germany hasn't had a big bubble in the property market, etc. There are all kinds of differences. But nonetheless, you may say that there's one similarity, two similarities. One, low consumer confidence and a sort of low appetite for risk, which has persisted for some time. And secondly, I think you might say, a government that talks constantly about reform, but it's not clear that it ever really does it, either in Japan or in Germany. And it may well be that this is the pessimal policy mix. Because if you talk about reform, you create uncertainty and nervousness, and you may depress investment. But you don't actually ever get the economic stimulus that a genuine, hard-edged reform program achieves. And in those respects, I think that Germany may be slightly like Japan and may partly explain your phenomenon as to why there are some countries which appear to be trapped into a sort of pessimistic mindset.
Mr. Kazumi, the Prime Minister of Japan, was in New York some months ago, and he was at a semi-public meeting, I guess, and he was being pressed as to why they don't act more aggressively on structural reform. And he said, well, I tell you, half my advisors say if I don't encourage more rapid structural reform, we're going to have a great crisis in Japan. The other half says if I do, we're going to have a great crisis in Japan. And I find it a little difficult, too. The reason Mr. Professor Shin thinks we ought to have some sympathy for the...
Well, I feel a bit out of my depth debating Paul Volcker. Paul Volcker is, in some ways, the architect of modern central banking, and I think most of what we know today stems from his tenure at the Federal Reserve. Since everyone here has some various constraints, and I'm the sort of loose cannon here, I have no official affiliation. Perhaps I can just elaborate on some of the comments. I think Paul Volcker made a very good point that you have a choice here between a slow, a shallow recession, but a slow recovery. And the question is, what's the alternative? Would you actually have a sharp recession and a sharp recovery? Well, in fact, if you read Herbert Hoover's memoirs, he sort of says, Andrew Mellon, of course, he comes from that banking family, was very fond of apparently talking about the depression after the Civil War in the U.S. when he says, there was a very deep recession for 1 year, and then within 1 year, everything recovered. And his father was brought back while he was traveling in England because there were also all kinds of orders backing up. I suppose one question is whether it's okay not to distinguish between different categories of expenditure. So is it okay to make up for the lack of investment by increasing consumption? And the question is, what are some of the forces that you're actually storing up there as you increase consumption financed by debt? And if the consumption is actually financed by a housing boom, and that housing boom is actually based on over-optimistic expectations about long-run asset prices, then if there is a shock, and the shock needn't be something that's generated internally, and we could envisage another terrorist attack or something like that, the downward forces would be that much larger. And I think it's the internal dynamics that debt generates that I think really is the unknown quantity. And in that sense, even among central bankers, I think there'd be disagreement. I think the Federal Reserve has been very much out on the limb. If you talk to other central bankers, I think they would be much more circumspect about this balance between the potential forces that are building up and just making up the gap.
I think the time has come to invite comments from...
Well, unless Charlie wants to...
Well, I was just going to come back on this particular issue, since we were both at a conference at the Bank for International Settlements recently on exactly this issue. I think it's very easy to say, well, there may be problems from building up excess amounts of debt, and it makes the economy more vulnerable if there's adverse shocks further down the road. But it's much harder to know when you're a policymaker and going along when a bubble is building up. When you can recognise that there might be a debt finance bubble building up, it then becomes rather difficult to do anything about it without causing exactly the havoc that you want to avoid. So my question to you is, what alternative policy would you actually want to pursue as compared to, say, what the Fed have pursued or what we at the Bank of England have pursued?
In one sentence, anyway.
In one sentence.
Perhaps like any good academic, perhaps I can sort of draw on the audience. On that
time for questions from the audience. Yes, sir. Do we have the mics?
There should be roving mics around
the room.
The
mics are here.
For some reason, they're all on the table here. I can't imagine why.
The microphone is the board.
They were all huddling here, these mics. So. There should also be roving microphones upstairs as well, and we hope people from the top tier will ask questions and get a bit of energy into this debate. It's as flat as the world economy at the moment. So.
Right, Christopher Johnson. I'd like to put it to the panel that the late Harold Macmillan had a point when he said, "What goes wrong in politics? Events, dear boy, events." Now, we've had two major events, one of them referred to in the title, Iraq. We've heard a lot about most of the title of this session, but very little about after Iraq, and nothing about 9/11. And I'd just like to ask the panel, whichever of them cares to answer, what kind of effect cataclysmic world events like this, of which there may well be more in the offing, have had on the recession and the recovery. are they in fact trivial when you get down to it? Does it just mean a few tourist journeys have been cancelled, a bit more military spending? Is the main cause of the world cycle to be found in the telecoms bubble and the stock market cycle? Or have these events added a new dimension, and how do we analyze them? For example, perhaps in terms of the enormous US military build-up, if you're a hyperpower, it seems you have a hyper-budget deficit to pay for the military spending. Are we entering something like the Vietnam indebtedness cycle, and this time it's sort of 30 years later, we may not have learned the lessons?
Thank you.
You got a question related to this? All right. And then we'll have quick answers from there.
Could you stand up and speak so that everyone up the top tier
Thank
can hear,
you,
and maybe everyone could say briefly who they are before they speak?
I'm Karunanidhi. I'm a physician. In England, we are termed as type 2 physicians.
And you have a short question.
It depends. Maybe I'll talk. I have a question to the one of the panelists from the developing country, President Fernando Lula Cardoso. President
Lula.
Henrik Cardoso. Okay, yeah.
Why not?
But the idea is the
you
Western
can put
idea.
Together, no problem.
The idea is the Western idea, the birth rate. Madam, the young Japanese executive's idea, it is being echoed by the faculty's Lord Desai's idea. Madam, not only in Japan, the whole Western world, I mean including the Europe, the birth rate is declining, the population is aging. But at the same time, none of you have got an immigration policy. You, the Japanese, could allow Koreans to come and work there. The Americans could pardon the Mexicans. And the Europeans, you've got the moral responsibility for the Commonwealth. Why is that? I think that the talent, of course, you are the talented. The courageous youth from the developing country are the only real engines to revive the shattered economy. I think that the world, the G8 leaders, you don't have got, you're all some sort of, what to say, the G's for, G, what is it, some sort of, I don't know the exact, you people, you don't have the vision to rule. The global vision. You all think about your own countries, budget or whatever. If you could think globally, we all could have a wonderful, wonderful. It's a greedy age. G8 is greedy age. Thank you.
Thank you.
At this level, you know that the overpopulation is
okay,
the independent spot, the wealth and health. Okay? Thank you.
We understand. I want to know that President Lula is following President Cardoso's policies. That's
yes.
why I can get
yes.
confused. But would the comment like to panel like to comment just very briefly? Obviously, you can't give a speech in answer to these things, but do great world events like Iraq affect things? So you got a one-sentence comment, and what about leadership?
Okay. Do great events have big economic implications? I think actually evidence from that is by and large no. September the 11th had a very big but quite ephemeral effect on the world economy. Similarly, Iraq, and if you go back to the Gulf War, you get a dip in business confidence, dip in activity that maybe lasts a quarter, and then things pretty much rebound. I think where the issue is not the direct effect of those events on the economy because of heightened uncertainty and things like that, but to the extent that they lead to changes in other policies, foreign policy, and the like, that they end up affecting the way economies interact. So I think that's the big issue, not the direct impact of these sorts of events on economies.
Anybody got anyone to add to that?
No doubts about that. Uncertainty was increased enormously. And this is a terrible ingredient for economic recovery, directly. I don't know if Lula will agree with me. Probably yes.
What questions do we have from up above? I am conscious that the birth rate of the world lies in your hands.
Okay, yes, in the middle.
Thank you. Me being person Brazilian as well, I did definitely.
Could you say who you are before you?
My name is Ronaldo Rigo, Jr. I'm a student doing general course here. I live in Miami, but I'm originally from Brazil. And I... I definitely understand. I mean, I
was going to ask.
Yeah. I definitely agree with some of the comments made about the willingness to take risk. I mean, we see during when we had the Cruzado in Brazil, and definitely the Rio plan was definitely a big risk that was undertaken and seemed to have succeeded in its main goals. Now, I wonder what kind of policies or what kind can a leader or can a country do to actually change the confidence or the way the individuals in that country think. I mean, I agree that the cultures and everything involved in different countries, like, for example, Argentina and Japan, there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of unwillingness to take risks. But how would someone go about changing that? How would someone change the willingness for individuals to take risks in these countries?
Oh, boy, you're our expert on political leadership, Mr. President.
Well, it's almost impossible to reply to your question because it depends on political leadership, exactly. Also, the big leaders have to take risks and to go ahead. But the point is that if you look globally, well, what can be done by a leader in Argentina or in Brazil is very limited. The question, again, is it depends largely on what will occur in the United States and in Europe. So I believe that Mr. Volker has much more experience about American politics than myself. If I would be there, I would say, well, continuing what has been the starting point of the American policy in the last year, my God, better to hope for a change.
Mr. Volker is in London, not in Washington. Yes, sir, up in the middle, a brief, succinct, pointed question from the gentleman with a polo shirt.
Also identifying yourself in a humorous fashion.
Sure. Ken Shadlin, lecturer here in development studies. I just have a very quick question. That is, in some ways, the gist of the discussion seemed to be the lessons of the 30s have been learned, and there is now sort of more stimulating fiscal and monetary policy. And I'm thinking, and the question is sort of, to what extent are the new mechanisms working? To what extent are we reaching the end of the runway? And when one looks at fiscal sort of tendencies in fiscal and monetary policy in the developing world, one thinks that maybe the lessons of the 30s haven't been learned, in which countries seem to be following very sort of pro-cyclical fiscal and monetary policies. And my question then, sort of twofold, is first is to what extent that matters for the world economy, or to what extent is the fact that slow-growing, large economies in the developing world, Brazil being one, follow sort of very sort of they don't follow the recipe of sort of more fiscal stimulus and lowering interest rates because they're somewhat constrained to do so. To what extent that matters to the world economy writ large, and to the extent that it does, I would certainly think that it does. I'm sure that President Cardoso thinks that it does. What's the thinking about what can be done about this so that the developing countries can also sort of live in an enlightened world of having learned the lessons of the 1930s?
If I may give a quick answer to that, the two biggest developing emerging economies in the world by far are China and India, both of which are doing quite well, thank you. China is growing 7-8% a year, India is doing 4-5% a year, and you're talking about 2 billion people. It is true that for many of these other countries, what they are doing doesn't matter a lot in terms of the strength of the world economy. But I want to make a point in reverse, which is why I seized the microphone. I think those countries are all small emerging countries are suffering from the instabilities inherent in the present world monetary system and things that don't bother the United States or Europe much in terms of big exchange rate changes because their big stable economic units are devastating to the Argentines, even the Brazils, which is a big country, but the small countries of Asia. And that's part of the reason why they're caught in kind of a cycle, in my opinion, where they're following policies that seem to you perverse, because they're trying so hard to maintain stability in an unstable monetary world.
Paul, could I just add something on the first part of the question, which was essentially, as I understood it, was really whether the traditional mechanisms of lowering interest rates and deficits were really working or whether we were pulling on a piece of elastic. I do think that it's important to remember, and it's surprising how quickly these things fade into the past, that we are still in the aftermath, and I look at this from a financial market point of view, of the most massive exercise in wealth, apparent wealth creation and wealth destruction we've seen for 70 years. and combined with a high degree of uncertainty and skepticism about corporate earnings and corporate accounting. And it's not surprising in those circumstances that it takes quite a bit of time for confidence to rebuild in the equity market, not just in the secondary market, but also in the primary market. And I think that that, to me, seems to explain quite a lot of the apparent unresponsiveness of business investment to the monetary stimulus that there's been.
I don't want to ignore, you know, the people, the older generation on the floor. Gentlemen over here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is George Kardush.
Would you like to stand up? Because it's easier for people to hear.
If I may, I would rather not stand up because I have a lot of junk on my lap, which is
okay.
Some of it has already fallen down.
We accept the reason.
And the first part of my question is to Professor Bean, whom, if I understood correctly, said that the stock market was fairly valued. As I understand it, the American stock market is trading now at 31 times earnings, and if you adjust for pension liabilities and stock options, it's a little over 40, whereas the long-term average is about 15. The second part of my question is directed to Mr. Volcker. What is your assessment of the efficacy of fiscal policy, especially the removal or cut in taxation on dividends, because some people maintain that dividends will not really, this cut in dividend tax will not work because the benefits are to the rich people who have a high marginal propensity to save. Thank you.
Mr. Green.
Okay, the question about whether stock market's fairly valued, I was making a sort of rather sweeping generalization about all stock markets, if you like, and inevitably there's variations across countries. And I think you can quite credibly make the case that the adjustment was not necessarily complete in the US. Of course, earnings ratios were way down on where they were if you go back 2 years ago, so a significant part of the adjustment occurred. The difficulty with all of these things is knowing exactly what constitutes a fair value. Merely looking at historical averages is not necessarily a good guide. You really need to take a punt on what's happened to discount rates, what's happened to equity risk premia, things like that. But I think compared to where we were 3-4 years ago, stock markets look more fairly valued certainly than they were then.
So far as American tax policy is concerned, I'm inclined to reverse my remark about Wagner's music. It's worse than it looks. It doesn't provide all that much stimulus in the short run, and it runs up big deficits over a period of time when it's least questionable whether we can afford them. Now, the question on dividend relief, philosophically, I happen to agree with, despite my comments, that the double taxation of dividends has for many years distorted company financial practices and encouraged an unhealthy amount of leveraging, and encourages an unhealthy reduction in dividends relatively. Unfortunately, even saying that, I think the more effective way and a more appropriate way of doing it would have been to give relief at the corporate level rather than on the individual level, which is going to lead to a lot of distortions and fancy financial engineering because it is so partial, affects directly a fairly limited and the wealthy portion of the community.
Hello, my name is Paul Flather, I'm from Oxford. We had some very interesting historical... apologies. At least the humour is keeping up. We had some very interesting historical comparisons, at least I found them very interesting, and we heard earlier that individual events don't seem to be making that much difference to the state of the world economy. And I just wondered if I could take this opportunity to ask such a distinguished panel of economists whether they thought the process of globalization in its broadest forms, does it make it easier for you as policymakers to control world affairs, or does it make it that much harder? And if it was to make it easier, can you do more about making the results more positive? the whole notion of good globalization.
Who would like to tackle that little question?
Shall I start? Because I was actually thinking I might put some words about globalization in my opening remarks, and I realized if I started doing that, there's no way I'd get into your six-minute limit. But it does seem to me that the issue of how we deal with globalization and ensure the returns from it are widely spread is actually one of the biggest problems that faces policymakers and those involved in designing the global economic architecture. I mean, it's something that, from a national policymaker's perspective, I think is a two-edged sword. At one level, it potentially raises potential welfare. You can get imports more cheaply, things like that. You can see that, for instance, in the UK by some of the beneficial movements in the terms of trade that we've had in the last few years. That's part of the reason why the UK has been able to, why we've been able to pump up demand without it necessarily feeding into to more inflation. So that's the good side of it. I mean, the bad side, or the difficult side from a policymaker's perspective, is it potentially makes an economy more open to external events. And you only have to look at to the Asia crisis going back a few years to show what integration of global markets, what problems they can cause, particularly for small developing countries. So, I mean, I think we're a long way from working out an architecture which gets the best out of it and the advantages from globalization, but does something to ameliorate some of the worst problems.
Anybody else want to?
Yeah. Let's add another comment. Well, the point from the perspective of a developing country is that it's a kind of incomplete globalization. We have a full globalization flow capital. This is financial globalization is there, but we don't have access to markets. So we don't have this, what has asked before, people cannot move around the world. So it's a very incomplete globalization. So the consequence of the incomplete globalization is not necessarily positive for the developing countries. It's true. Mm-hmm. Even you can open our markets, you can import and ship goods and so on and so forth. But from time to time, we need to export. And when we are trying to export, we have barriers preventing us to export, access to markets. So we have an absolutely asymmetric globalization. So for developing countries, a tremendous burden is not a benefit.
Can I just have a two-hander quickly to emphasize that when I was talking about imports being useful, I was meaning imports of developing country goods to the UK. So I'm all in favor of giving developing countries access to developed country markets.
I would like to add one comment based on my experience as an investment banker. This globalization, success of globalization depends on who set the rule. If America set a rule and they have got more advantage to access more important rules than a country like Argentina. When the domestic financial market is very limited or small, they have to depend their funding in overseas market. And when they have financial problems domestically, I think that this globalization rule makes underdeveloping country to control their own monetary policy. I may be wrong, but this is something I learned from my experience in investment banking. So it's this rule is always set by the America or.
This is obviously a subject that attracts much analysis and much emotion. Let me summarize my own view in a little paradox. It seems to me the emerging countries have the most to gain, potentially, and that means the market should be open. and they are the most to gain from export markets and from capital inflows. But unfortunately, I think they are most in jeopardy from the volatility that's involved. So they both have the most to gain and the most risk. And I think we've been seeing a little more risk than gain recently. But that's not the way, that's the challenge. Right, yeah, why don't the young lady in the front. All the students that ask questions are in the middle
I'm
of the room.
I'm Claudia, sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm Claudia Diani, I'm a student, a graduate student here at LSE. And I have a question for President Cardoso. President, you mentioned that one of the problems of the world economy is the lack of willing of the countries to take risks. And then you mentioned the comparison between Brazil and Argentina. So I would ask you, what kind of risk Brazil is taking that Argentina is not taking, since Brazil is, like, when you were the president, is still carrying on these orthodox policies? And also, if you think that Brazil and developing countries should adopt less orthodox policies. And
yeah. Where are you from?
Brazil.
Well, let me say very, very briefly. First of all, I was referring to Japan and Germany when I spoke about to take risks. What kind of risks? For instance, in the case of Japan, to restructure the financial system, the banks. We did in Brazil. It cost a lot, but we did. We closed banks, et cetera. It cost a lot of money for the nation, maybe 2 or 3% of GDP. But now we have a sound financial system. Again, in the case of comparing Brazil to Argentina, we put order in the states in terms of the fiscal situation in the states. The Argentinians didn't. So this is not to say that I'm preaching for orthodoxy. This is your word, not mine. You see? What I'm preaching is for responsibility. And this is a quite different thing. You have to take into account that if you have inflation, who's pay more for inflation than any other? It's the more unjust taxes inflation. So you have to be responsible when being in government, trying to control expenses. That's not to say that it's not necessary to look at the social area. On the contrary, in the case of Brazil, it's quite clear. The expense in terms of GDP increased enormously after the monetary equilibrium. So, and you create a network of social protection, and you are spending more in health, more in education than ever, and in spite of the fact that you have been very strict in trying to control the budget, as the present government is trying to do too. So it's not, I'm not referring to orthodoxy, but to responsibility.
Yes, sir.
My name's Howard Goldring. I'd like the panel to comment about the Growth and Sterility Pact that we have in Europe and what chances they think of it being amended so you don't have the crazy situation of the Germans increasing taxes into a downturn.
Good. A good direct question which each of you can respond to quickly.
What are the chances of it being amended? I think it will be amended eventually. I think it's more likely that the next few years we'll see it interpreted more liberally and more flexibly because there's too much political capital in the Stability and Growth Pact as it stands at the moment. But I think inevitably it has to be redesigned to allow somewhat more flexibility and also to focus on the things that matter, which are not budget deficits but debt and issues of fiscal sustainability.
Howard?
Well, I agree with Charlie. I'm required to say that before any answer. But I would also add that, in my view, one of the reasons why the Stability and Growth Pact has been so problematical in the last 2 or 3 years, in my view, is because people went into economic and monetary union in some cases through devices on the fiscal side, which meant that their positions were not sort of stable at a neutral point? I mean, in theory, if you were at a zero deficit at a midpoint of a cycle, then 3% up or down ought not to be too difficult. But I suspect that what happened was that people were centered at somewhere other than a budget balance in the middle of the cycle. And so I think we need to look not just at the construction of the Stability and Growth Pact, but also at the circumstances in which it was started, and not therefore make reforms which abandon all elements of fiscal discipline within a monetary union, which I think will be important to keep.
Professor, can I just say... I'll just say organisationally we have to finish pretty sharply soon. Paul Volcker is just going to put a conundrum to the panel, and then we have to finish shortly after that. But I ask everyone to stay in their seats after we've done so, at least for a minute or two, if you would.
I don't know if it's a conundrum or not, but we have all these people sitting up above in the balcony, mostly students, or all for students of the LSE. Let me ask you a simple question, and I don't know quite how to phrase it. I'll phrase it more simply than it is. How many of you would vote for more globalization as opposed to less? I will say more first and then less. And I guess you shout. And whoever shouts the loudest wins. Who wants more movement toward globalization?
Yes, it depends.
Who wants slower or less? Who won, Professor Goodness?
Less. Less won. But I mean, you should spend more time at the LSE if you think we need less globalization.
Well, thank you. I think you're finished.
We now have got an important organizational announcement. While this is, just before this happening, let me tell you just something about, you know that Huon had this story of an aeroplane taking off. Let me tell you a story about the world's first fully computerized airliner. It's an airliner with no crew, no staff, so all the passengers come to the plane and they get on the thing that gets you in the plane. It goes up automatically and they all get in their seats and this disembodied voice comes on and says, "Welcome aboard the world's first fully computerized airliner. Please sit back and relax." And the plane accelerates and starts to take off. And the disembodied voice says, "Please relax. Nothing can go wrong. Nothing can go wrong. Nothing can go wrong." Alan, please make your announcement as a disembodied voice.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we'll now have an interval of 30 minutes. Due to space restrictions, refreshments will be served in two locations. If you have a white folder ticket, can I please ask you to make your way out to the Student Services Centre, which is just out and across the passageway there. If you have a single-sided red or single-sided black and white ticket, please can I ask that you make your way to the Quad. This is in the East Building, opposite the Old Building. Please show your tickets to stewards and they will assist you with directions.
But, hold on.
The second session begins promptly at 5 o'clock, so don't be late.
Please do not move. Look, this has been, after a sort of, I thought, slightly slow start, it's been a bloody good session, so please show your appreciation of the panel to you. And could I also thank Paul for his lively chairmanship? Please all come back for the second session. Would you just stay in your seats while the panel leaves, though, if you wouldn't mind? Thank you. Thank you. Well, can I welcome everyone to the second of the sessions, which is going to focus more upon inequalities in global society and problems of development. As Paul pointed out in the session this morning, the picture for the less developed world is mixed at the moment. China doing very well still, India doing pretty well. In Africa, actually, GDP growth has remained quite resilient over the past 3 or 4 years, reflecting, I think, better macroeconomic policies and certain amount of regional stability, but of course there are major structural shocks with the resurgence of famine in the southern part of Africa, instability in Zimbabwe, major conflicts still going on in the Ivory Coast, and of course the impact of AIDS. Latin America, we discussed briefly this morning, had one of its worst years in 2001-2, but has recovered this year with a certain amount of export-led growth, so the picture is pretty mixed, I think. We have, as before, a very distinguished panel. The missing link on the panel is in the washroom somewhere, but she is due to appear any second, so I think we should start anyway. So can I introduce the existing members of the panel, and I'm sure we'll have a full panel in a couple of minutes. Gro Harlem Brundtland is very well known to everybody here. She is Director General of the World Health Organization and, of course, had a very, very distinguished political career in her own country. Professor David Held, I'm very pleased to welcome onto the panel, an old friend and colleague of mine. He is a kind of example of himself because he is probably the biggest global expert on globalization. And we're very happy that he's joined the LSE. Nick Stern is another LSE product and, till recently, professor at the LSE. I think I can say one of the most dedicated servants of the LSE, has helped us in so many ways, certainly since I've been here. I'd like to thank him for that. Chief economist at the World Bank, and now moving on to another high-powered job, thankfully back in this country. Long Yong Tu is Secretary General of the Bao Forum for Asia, Vice Minister, Ministry of Foreign Trade Cooperation of the People's Republic of China. He is also an LSE alumnus, and it's very good to welcome him back at the LSE. The person who just sneaked onto the panel at the last second, which is just-in-time politics, is the Right Honourable Patricia Hewitt, MP. I first met Patricia when she was the director of the IPPR, which I was also involved a few years ago, still am involved. It's a great pleasure to have her here on the panel. I'm really grateful that you agreed to come and that you stage manage your appearance so brilliantly.
On time, but on budget.
I should just point... I should point out, Patricia, that these proceedings are being recorded for Brazilian television.
Wow.
But news does get back, so I ought to warn you, it's not Chatham House Rules meeting. As with this morning, same format. If you don't mind, speakers, please speak for no longer than 6 minutes. Paul Volcker, he used to regulate the world economy. He can surely regulate a panel of this size. He did so very effectively this morning. He's going to make sure you stick to your 6 minutes. Then Paul will say something in relation to what the speakers themselves said. There'll be a bit of dialogue between the speakers, and then we'll open the whole thing up to the audience as we did in the previous session. As we did earlier, we'll also go in alphabetical order, so I'll ask Gro Harlem Brundtland to kick off, and from this second onwards, Paul becomes the chair of the panel. So, Gro, perhaps you'd like to start.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. It's nice to be here. Now, first of all, I think we must be aware that we live in a world where too often rich and poor, countries, both countries, and people within countries continue to grow apart. In terms of their health, their current livelihoods, and their prospects for the future. That's the big picture. The traditional division into developed and developing countries may no longer be the best way to look at this problem. There are, of course, the wealthy countries. But there are also a group of what were developing countries, which are by no means rich, but which are making steady progress. And then there are others, those that briefly seize the world's attention at moments of acute crisis, but which otherwise disappear from our screens. Those that are not part of anyone's development model, those that risk being left behind. We are not dealing here with small numbers. In the last 10 years of the 20th century, the Human Development Index declined in nearly 30 countries. Some countries have seen decades of stagnation. The causes are manifold and interlinked. The impact of HIV/AIDS, drought and natural disasters, chronic underinvestment in human development, failures of governance, all take their toll. For those that emerge with hope from the ashes of conflict, like Mozambique, Cambodia, or Uganda, there are many more, of which Iraq is but one, where continuing insecurity prevents the best efforts to provide essential services to those most in need. So my first reaction to the question is, if we allow the gap between the rich and the poor to widen, no one wins, and both rich and poor will pay. The costs to the poor are self-evident. Poverty and conflict breed disease more than any other single cause, just as disease breeds poverty. The benefits, too, are clear. We now have solid evidence to show how health can contribute to economic development and to poverty reduction. The reality is this: we are living in an interdependent and interconnected world. There are no impregnable walls between the world that is healthy, well-fed, and well-off, and the other world, which is sick, malnourished, and impoverished. So finding ways of building trust and forging a sense of solidarity is, to my mind, one of the most critical elements of globalization. SARS has been a wake-up call. It has shown us the potential gains from international collaboration, as well as some of the pitfalls when collaboration fails. But there are many other issues which should claim our attention. The right of the poor to enjoy better livelihoods depends on the actions of all governments, in the north as well as in the south. Several points should be on our agenda, meeting our obligation to provide additional development finance, opening markets, and removing the obstacles that currently face developing country exporters, advancing human development and institution building, being prepared to invest in peacekeeping and conflict prevention, staying the course in post-conflict reconstruction and rehabilitation, very often not done, and financing global public goods such as surveillance systems and research into new medicines and vaccines. These are investments from which we all can benefit, but which no one can individually afford or even do. We have a roadmap, starting from the Millennium Declaration through promises of a new trade round in Doha with development as its main theme, taking on the commitments for increasing aid made as part of the Monterrey Consensus and then reaffirmed at the World Summit of Sustainable Development in Johannesburg. So we have seen some encouraging signs of solidarity, particularly in scaling up the efforts to combat AIDS, TB, and malaria, and the focus on achieving the Millennium Development Goals. But we have also seen at one international negotiation after another how hard it is to forge a sense of solidarity when the atmosphere is dominated by a burning sense of injustice on the one hand and lack of real commitment on the other. The events of recent months, including the build-up to the war in Iraq and its immediate aftermath, suggest to me we have reached a tipping point, a very fine balance. One direction points to ever greater distance between those that can access the fruits of development and those that remain excluded. The other direction recognizes our dependence on each other and acts accordingly. The way that we, the world community, now act to address current crises and prevent future ones will not only provide the answer to the question this panel has been asked to address, it will determine whether we succeed or fail in our shared efforts to advance global development, growth, and peace. Thank you.
Right on the button in timing, my preoccupation here. We'll see how the professor does. David Hill.
Well, we don't do very well generally. We prefer 100 words when one might do, but I will do my best to make an hours-long lecture in now 5 minutes 45 seconds. I'm going to, I think, build on some of the things you said. I agree greatly with nearly everything you said, and so I'll slightly adjust what I'm going to say in light of what you've said. And I'd like to start by saying something briefly about global inequality and then saying something briefly about what we might do about it. For many, clearly global inequality is among, if not the most critical issue on the contemporary political agenda. Yet the debate about its causes and consequences are complex. The principal division is between those who understand global inequality as the inevitable product of 2 centuries of industrialization in the West, and who interpret globalization as a powerful force for spreading wealth and reducing poverty, and those who argue essentially the opposite, that globalization is creating more immiseration and a more unequal world. There's some truth to both of these positions, and there's something wrong with both of them as well. The data on global inequality and poverty is incomplete and patchy for many parts of the world, notably India, China, and large parts of Africa. But I think, as far as I can tell, 5 things seem to be occurring simultaneously. Firstly, the absolute gap, which you have spoken about, between the world's richest and poorest states, the richest and poorest peoples in the world, is now at historic levels and accelerating. Secondly, the proportion of the world's population living in absolute poverty, that is on a dollar a day, appears to be declining. Although this is a contested claim, it is generally accepted that the proportion of the world's population living in absolute poverty has declined throughout the 1990s from 29% to 23%. Thirdly, there are rapidly diverging patterns of life chances between men and women. Severe forms of impoverishment, social exclusion, and inequality are particularly virulent among women. Today, poverty and ill health too often have, as Kofi Annan put it, a woman's face. 70% of the 1.2 billion people living on less than a dollar a day, for example, are women, and twice as many women as men among the world's 900 million illiterates. Thirdly, there are significant shifts between region and between country patterns of economic, fourthly, there are significant shifts between region and between country patterns of economic inequality. That is to say, these inequalities are not simply rigidly given across countries and across regions. Countries and regions can change position in this global pattern of inequality. In other words, just as there's people mobility and individual mobility within countries, so there's country mobility within this worldwide pattern of global inequality. And we've seen that in terms of the rapid progress of many East Asian economies, for example, in the last 30 years. And fifthly and finally, within country inequality appears to have increased since the 1980s in several countries, for example, in Asia, China, Thailand, Malaysia, and Latin America, Chile, Colombia, Mexico, while remaining stable in others. The key point from this complex picture that I take, the key point I want to draw from these findings, is that while globalization can be enormously beneficial for economic development, growth, and the extent of individual life chances, it isn't necessarily so. Globalization has to be carefully managed and regulated to make it so. In my judgment, it's no good. In fact, it's quite bad just being tough in pursuit of free trade, capital market liberalization, the deregulation of all markets and liberal politics. In other words, simply pursuing what we refer to as the so-called Washington consensus. We need, as Tony Blair once put it on about crime, we need to be tough in pursuit of free markets while insisting upon a framework of shared values and common institutional practices. That means balancing open markets with strong governance, social protection, and distributive justice at the global level. If globalization is to work for all, we need to calibrate the freeing of markets with poverty reduction programs and the immediate protection of the vulnerable, north, south, east, and west. Now, if this is all I would say, it would be too general. So let me use my last minute and a half or so by saying what I think this comes down to in terms of an agenda for progressive global governance. In the first instance, it seems to me, it requires that we make a success of the Doha trade round and ensure it's a development round that brings serious benefits to the world's poorest countries. This outcome is by no means assured, and are enemies of such an outcome. Secondly, I think we need to reform the TRIPS agreement to ensure it is compatible with public health and welfare. There is urgent recognition of this problem, but how far this agenda will be seen through, again, remains an open question. They're enemies for the reform of TRIPS. Thirdly, we need to recognize that for many developing countries, and this is more controversial still, phasing in the integration into global markets and only pursuing this agenda after necessary domestic, political, and economic reforms are in place is perhaps far more important than a commitment to openness per se. Next, we need to build on organizations like the WTO Legal Advisory Center to expand the capacity of developing countries to engage productively in the institutions of governance of the world economy. We need to set a clear timetable for governments to reach the UN 0.7% GNP overseas aid target and raise this sum to 1% in due course. We need to untie aid budgets completely. We need to seek further support for the reduction of international debt to countries already that have paid back more in interest than the initial debt sums they ever owed. We need to improve cooperation among international financial institutions and international donors, thus consolidating the often contradictory policy-making efforts at the international community within the UN. And in my last few seconds, we need to, in addition, open international financial institutions to enhance developing country involvement in places, for example, where they're excluded, the Financial Stability Forum and the Basel Committees. And we need, I think, finally, to institute a review of the functioning of the Bretton Woods institutions created more than 50 years ago and now operating in a context, an economic context, that has drastically changed. Thank you.
Professor Harold has done the impossible. He has more items on his agenda than he had minutes, and he somehow succeeded. Ms. Stewart.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. I agree very strongly, I think, with almost everything that both Grow and David have just said. So let me add to that, and particularly pick up on what David was just saying about the World Trade negotiations and the Doha Development Round, because I think the great challenge for us now in the world is to create different rules and much stronger institutions for the governance of the global economy. And above all, that means creating a framework of rules for world trade that is going to be fair as well as free and can thus enable developing countries to trade their way out of poverty. That is, President Chissano of Mozambique, for instance, was saying recently, that is what developing countries want, not to be dependent on rich countries' aid budgets. But if we're going to fulfill the hopes that we raised when we launched the Doha Development Round 18 months or so ago, and it's the first trade round that was committed to development, then the developed world has got to step up to the mark. And the reality is, with less than 100 days to go before we meet for the ministerial WTO meeting in Cancun in Mexico, which is supposed to be the halfway point of the Doha Development Round negotiations, the reality is we haven't made nearly as much progress as we should have made since we launched the round in November 2001. Now, the first barrier between us and a successful next step at Cancun is undoubtedly TRIPS, the patent rules, and access to medicines. We very nearly clinched that deal, the details of the deal following Doha, in the WTO discussions in Geneva just before Christmas. No disagreement on it between the developing countries and the European Union, but the United States unwilling to sign up because of issues their pharmaceutical companies have and a fear that some of the more developed developing countries, notably Brazil and India, will use the agreement not for the public health medicines, the HIV, AIDS, TB, malaria, those big public health emergencies, which is what we focused on at Doha, but in fact to move into licensed production of drugs for a whole host of other conditions. I believe very strongly that those fears are wholly misplaced. I've discussed it with the Brazilian trade minister recently and with the Indian trade minister, and I hope that we will fulfill the request made by the G8 heads of government recently that we resolve this issue on access to medicines before Cancun. If we don't, we will create profound mistrust once again within the developing world about the intentions of the developed world, and we will significantly reduce the chances of success. But the second big issue is agriculture. And the reality is that with over a billion people in the world living on less than a dollar a day, we in the European Union have a common agricultural policy, a set of agriculture subsidies that amount to $2 a day for every cow in Europe. Utterly disgraceful. And the United States is not far behind us when it comes to the level of agriculture subsidies. They massively subsidize cotton to the detriment of producers, far more efficient, cheaper producers in poorer countries of the world. We massively subsidize sugar to such an extent that Finland is a producer of sugar, a product in which they have no natural or geographic advantage whatsoever. Again, to the massive detriment of countries like Mozambique. This week in the Agriculture Council, it's the third week in a row we're having a shot at this, we have a real opportunity to agree in the midterm review some significant improvements, not everything, but significant improvements to the common agricultural policy that in turn would allow us to make an improved offer to the developing countries in Cancun. But it's a challenge to all the developed countries, not only the European Union. I believe, very much for the reasons that David outlined, that if we can increase trade on the basis of a fair framework around the world, then that process of market opening and greater trade will benefit all countries, just as it helped to pull Europe's countries out of poverty over the last 50 years. We will have to make our own adjustments. Look at the pain of adjustment in the textile and clothing industry here, and it will have to come in America as they open their markets. But the priority has to be development. And I think that means for the developed world, we have to be willing to sign up at Doha and at Cancun and beyond, even if the proposals are not of benefit to UK PLC. And conversely, we must reject proposals that do not benefit or that it might damage the developing world, and particularly the least developing countries, the least developed countries of the world. And those two propositions, let me say, will be our guiding principles, certainly my guiding principles, as I lead the UK government delegation to Cancun in September.
I just want to say before we go on that I was so excited to see Patricia arrive that I forgot to say what her job is. She's got several jobs, but her main job is Secretary of State for Trade and Industry.
Mr. Stern.
Thank you very much, Paul. I'm a little bit worried that there's an egregious outbreak of agreement amongst the panel, which is very out of character with the spirit of the LSE, and the anarchic spirit in me wants to try and break it some way. But the problem is that I agree with most of what has been said, and indeed recognize many of the numbers because we produce them. But the
thank you, Nick.
And I take them very seriously. Let me just talk about the responsibilities of the rich countries to change the balance of who gains and who loses. And there are three directions here. There's output, trade, and capital flows. Now, on the output side, developing countries now have national incomes which are much more closely correlated with the national incomes of the rich countries than they were 20 or 30 years ago. The reason for that is tremendous success in increasing their involvement in world trade. The export to GDP ratio of poor countries in the last 20 years has gone up from around 14% to about 24%, a massive increase in their involvement in world trade. And the manufacturing share in their exports has gone up from less than one-third to more than two-thirds. So for those reasons, increasing exports to GDP and increasing share of manufacturing in their exports, their cycles are now much more correlated with rich country cycles than they used to be. The consequence of that is an increased responsibility of the rich countries to stabilize and increase their output growth. It matters not just to them, but because of that direct increasing interlinkage, higher correlation, it matters also to poor countries. I'm sure you discussed this morning about when the pickup is coming in the rich countries. I do see it coming, but it's a very slow recovery from a very long boom and a very dramatic crash. Now, the second linkage is in trade. Now, Patricia spoke very clearly about the barriers associated with subsidies. So let me talk about other barriers. There are a lot of barriers that have to do with tariffs. The tariffs that poor countries face on their agricultural exports are about 10 times as high as the rich countries face on their manufacturing exports. The barriers are high precisely where the poor countries have a comparative advantage. So in that sense, it's hypocritical to encourage countries to go for free trade, which does help them, in my view, whilst at the same time erecting barriers precisely where they have the comparative advantage. Second source of barriers is the non-tariff barriers. Let me give you one example. Camel's cheese from Mauritania. It apparently is very good, and it was a joint collaboration between a French cheesemaker and the camels and the camel owners. And it was destined, you know, won prizes in shows, and it was destined for really high profit margins, notwithstanding they were going to slap heavy taxes on it. But what happened? Some bureaucratic genius in Brussels said that they couldn't guarantee that the camel cheeses were safe unless it could be proved and certificated that those camels had been milked mechanically. Now, I don't know how many of you tried to buy a camel milking machine recently, but if you're a poor Mauritanian camel herder living on a good bit less than $1 a day, it's hopeless, and that killed it off. If you want to tell your students what is a non-tariff barrier, that's one. Impossible documentation requirements. The Everything But Arms Agreement for imports from poor countries into the European Union, which is celebrated as a gesture in the right direction, it is a move in the right direction. Half of the imports eligible can't get in because they don't have convincing or allegedly convincing proof of origin. That's a non-tariff barriers. Virtually all the anti-dumping measures that take place in the WTO are rich countries against poor countries. That's a non-tariff barrier. So as well as the subsidies, they're the very high tariffs and they're the very heavy non-tariff barriers. Wherever you look, the playing field is very far from level. The gains from trade are enormous. Several hundred billion dollars a year, if you look a few years down the track, from a really strong move in Doha, a few hundred million people out of poverty. And the reason that Doha is at such severe risk is the lack of progress in the rich countries on the agricultural front. And I strongly agree with Patricia Hewitt that unless we see movement there, we are not going to see progress in Doha. The poor countries will quite understandably say, you said it was a development round, you're not behaving as if it is. Finally, on aid. If you look at what's happened to aid, in the 1960s, the fraction of rich country aid in relation to GDP was about 0.5%. It's now barely over 0.2%. The absolute quantity of aid has declined during the 1990s from around 60 to a little over $50 billion a year. The poor countries have seen no serious peace dividend from the end of the Cold War, though it's declined and as the rich countries have got richer. The paradox and what's deeply worrying in all this is that aid has never been more productive. Why? Because poor country policies have improved very remarkably over the last 20 years, whether you look at macro policy, trade policy, structural policy, governance. Long way to go, of course, but the poor country policies have improved. That's one reason why aid is more productive. Aid is better allocated. It's still allocated politically, but less politically than it was 10 or 15 years ago. That's another reason why aid is more productive. And I like to think that the aid agencies certainly differed. If you put the World Bank to one side, I think it's true of the World Bank as well, but certainly differed have got much better at what they do. So I think for all those three reasons, aid has become more productive. But what has happened? We've seen a real decline in aid during the 1990s and a dramatic decline over the last 40 years or so in the fraction given by rich countries. That paradox seems to me to be deeply sad, to put it mildly.
Mr. Young, too.
Thank you. Very happy to be back to the school after 30 years. But I got a little bit worried about what kind of marks Professor Giddens will give me as a student. Especially I'm getting a little bit worried towards the end of last panel. There was a vote on more globalization or less globalization. And it seemed to me that Professor Giddens was on the side of less globalization, while I myself would be on the side of more globalization. However, I still believe there's too much simplification. Just divide more globalization and less globalization. There must be some common ground between the two factors. So I'm getting a little bit of confidence. Maybe I'll still get some good marks from Professor Giddens. I hope so. Feel comfortable from my fellows. Students now in London School of Economics. Anyway, today I'm trying to address a very important issue on the relationship between the trade policy and the development policy. Because when you're talking about development, you always associate something very good, economic growth, more employment, more jobs, and more social security and social stability. But when you're talking about trade policy, especially from the minister or trade representatives from developing countries, if you are trying to liberalize your market in your trade policy, you always describe yourself. People also describe yourselves as someone betraying your national interest because you opened up your market and the foreign products come in your market and wiped out your national industry. And as the chief negotiator of China for trade for more than 10 years, I have been under tremendous pressure in pursuing this job to get China into WTO, because people always think that I'm trying to betray my country because I try to convince my people that we have to abide by the international rules and practice. We have to open our market a little bit more open to the rest of the world. However, I can tell you that according to Chinese experience, this trade policy and development policy could be mutually reinforced and mutually complementary. And we should not put the trade policy and development policy on two opposite sides. For instance, during China's WTO accession, we have committed ourselves to abiding by international rules and practice and introduce many new principles to China. For instance, national treatment. That means in terms of trade, you have to trade the foreign enterprise and the Chinese enterprise the same way. And then a much more fundamental debate took place in China. If we should treat the foreign enterprise the same way as we treat the Chinese enterprises, then first of all, in China, we have to treat the state-owned industrial and the private sector industry the same way, because that is where the national treatment should be applied first. So that kind of debate really had a fundamental impact on China's economic policy. So now we are now eliminating the kind of discrimination against the private sector in China in terms of its access to land, access to bank loans, or access to some of the very sensitive areas like communication, telecommunication, banking, insurance. I think this kind of introduction of the new concept of international practice into China has a fundamental impact on China's economic reform. I can cite another example, transparency. Transparency is something that we have committed ourselves very profoundly in our WTO commitment. Now we understand after SARS, it not only applies to economic trade field, it should also apply to social and political areas. And so this kind of negotiation in the trade areas, the trade policy areas, really has been taken by the Chinese leadership as a leverage to facilitate the Chinese economic reform. As you know that for the economic growth of a developing country, your internal economic reform is the most fundamental factor, because without that kind of reform, without them reform towards the market economy, you can hardly develop the economy. And you cannot simply depend on aid or other the kind of preferential treatment of other countries. And in terms of opening of China's market, I think we have also benefited from this process. Before, China's auto industry was mostly protected. However, because of our accession to WTO, we opened up our auto market. And last year, the first year of China's WTO accession, the trade sale and trade in production in China both increased by 50%. And this year, we are expecting 75% increase. And I can cite another example, job creation. Because during the WTO accession, we have made a lot of commitment to opening China's service sector, from law, legal service, accounting service, insurance service, banking service, telecommunication service, distribution services. And we opened up these sectors that generated a lot of new jobs, especially the middle income and the high income jobs. That is a very important measure that will keep the best talent of China in China, so not let them go to the United States and other developing countries. There's such a fast rate. And because we have to create middle income and high income jobs for them. If we do not open up those kind of service sectors, we cannot create new jobs for them. And every year, there are 2 million university students coming out of the university campus from China. That's a huge pressure on us to create jobs for them. So what I'm trying to say is that we should trade the trade policy side by side with development side, development policies. If we can pursue a right trade policy, we can enhance our economic development. However, I have to also emphasize in formulating the international rules and practice, we should have full and more participation of the developing countries, because to make the trade rules fair and make the trade free. It's a fair and free trade. It's not only free. So the more participation of the developing world is very critical. And another important thing is that in applying the international rules and practice, there should be no practice of double standard, because in some of the countries they have many more lawyers, they have more human resources, so they can interpret the laws the way they like. And so we really should look at all these sides, the rule side, and in opening of the market side, I think it should be an opening of the mutual opening. It's not a unilateral opening of the developing countries to the developed world. Developed world, this agricultural sector is so much protected. And the agricultural products are a major export of the developing world. So I think it's very important to kind of a mutual opening of the market. And another important dimension is that the opening of market of developing world should be a gradual process, because you have to first cultivate the market before you get into the market. Because if the negotiators of a developed world try very hard to open a market of developing countries and they find that the market is not there because there's no economic growth and there's no domestic demand. So anyway, I believe we were talking about who wins, who pays. I believe the principle of win-win. I think the developing world and the developed world should avoid confrontation and stand for cooperation. And the win-win concept is a new concept that we have introduced into China. In traditional, China's always believe you dead or alive, just like some kung fu film. But with this acceptance of the win-win concept, I think we have a much broader view about the globalization. Thank you very much.
This is a really remarkable panel in my experience. I think of these development types as, you know, a lot of talk, not very disciplined, full of emotion, not much hard analysis. I never saw a panel that stayed so close to the time limits as this particular panel did. I think it's wonderful, a large part of agreement. I don't have much to add to what they say except, I don't know, my problem is to be a little cynical in my old age, I guess. You know, we all like to think that globalization is good. We kind of take that by assumption, but we find out it ain't necessarily so as it works out in practice. And we have to find the things that make it so, and that's what I think the panel is talking about. And they have pretty much agreed on a series of things that are important and useful. But from my point of view, we find it possible to put into practice a lot of the things that they're talking about, the things that come relatively easily and don't cost the big countries much. Might cost them a little money, but it doesn't cost them a big political problem or a really big amount of money. And we are forthcoming a little bit anyway on health, because health is a threat to us as well as to the emerging countries. We talk endlessly about good government and accounting and all those kinds of things, which are good for the other countries, don't cost us anything. We talk about corruption. We talk about some trade. We talk about how nice it is to have them join WTO so they open up their markets. That's mainly what we're thinking of. But then when it comes to a couple of big issues that have been touched upon here and one that hasn't been touched upon, I begin to wonder whether there is not an inherent political problem which Professor Feld is going to tell me how to solve. The big countries that have control of this situation don't do very well when it comes to something that really extracts a domestic cost. And we've talked about agriculture, and that's one of them. And we've talked about liberalizing agriculture and reducing subsidies in the developed world forever. The amount of progress that has been made is very little. And we talk about it at Doha, but what are the real chances of a breakthrough there? I express a little skepticism about that point, because it does extract a real cost in the perceptions in the developed world itself, both economic and socially. The environmental problem is more general, and I don't have to labor that. But let me raise the question of money. Mr. Stern says something that's very hopeful. He says we know how to spend money better than we used to, if I understood him correctly. There's a lot of question in the world whether we really know how to spend it very well when it gets big. I was struck, I don't know, what was it, the Times this morning had a big article about the inefficiency of the regional development plans in well-developed UK. And it's just an illustration that if we can't, I don't know the reality of that article, but I know there's a lot of skepticism about the effectiveness of spending really sizable amounts of money for some general development purposes internationally, and it's even true domestically. And I just raise a question with the panel, is this really, to what extent is it a money issue in a big sense, a money issue that costs, you know, not just a few billion dollars for AIDS or whatever, but you get in the area of hundreds of million dollars. Is it that kind of a problem? Does it help? And if that's the problem, will we ever have the political will and resources to do it in a developed world when it really begins talking about taxes and something important? So I leave you with a few questions which Mr. Giddens can answer.
I'm not going to answer, but I mean, I was supposed to be like the general supervisor of this event, but it's very hard for me to keep quiet all the time like I did this morning, so I'd like to just lob in a couple of questions. I'd like to ask Nick Stern. We had President Cardoso on the panel this morning, the former president of Brazil. Now we have a new president of Brazil with a radical program. Brazil has about the worst Gini coefficient in the world, really. Massive inequalities. I'd like to ask Nick, is there anything that you would do that President da Silva is not doing that would allow us to square the circle to get some decent level of economic development in Brazil against this background of the debt, of huge debt, while still doing something about the inequalities in the country? I'd like to ask Patricia, essentially, what do we do about George Bush? Because well, I think this is an issue that we do have to discuss, because the Bush security doctrine seems to me a straightforward America first doctrine, which cannot be acceptable to the rest of the world. The Bush administration seems prepared to link this even to regional economic conflicts and not to worry too much if there's an emerging economic war, as it were, between the EU and the US. There's a fair amount of money going to Africa to fight AIDS, which surely is a good thing, but it's quite hard to see how you're going to get the kind of world that David Held was talking about, which would seem to depend intrinsically upon multilateralism. Well, all the panelists will seem to depend really upon increasing multilateralism when you've got the largest state in the world, which is acting seemingly quite differently.
Can I try both the questions at Paul answered and Paul asked and you asked, Tony. Why is it that nothing happens? Well, you know, one of the reasons was identified very clearly by Machiavelli 500 years ago in Chapter 6 of The Prince, which all good LSE students still read. And he said that essentially the problem is that the people who lose from reform know who they are and can identify their losses, and those losses are concentrated, but those who would gain from the reform are quite widely dispersed. They may be future generations, and it's very difficult to organize them politically. That's why he said that, you know, that the reformer will be endlessly pursued, and he went on later in the chapter to talk about the armed prophet. You know, if you're going to be a prophet, you better have something behind you to move these things. But that problem is still there. But I think it's a failure. The challenge then is in politics, and I think the failure is largely one of politics. It's the failure of people like ourselves who are on the panel, who have the evidence for these things and can show it, but we clearly have not yet mobilized politically sufficiently effectively. We, in the grand sense, it's my job as chief economist of the World Bank, would be to provide the arguments and the analysis and the numbers and so on, not actually to do the political mobilization myself. But what we saw on the debt front was extraordinarily effective, and we haven't seen the same thing on the trade front or the aid front. Both of them are actually more difficult to get your arms around than debt. But I think that communication, armed with decent analysis, is the challenge, and we have to get better at it. People in political life themselves, I think, have to be leaders and courageous. I actually think the British government has done very well on the subjects that we've been talking about, so I certainly don't point the finger here. How to spend the money better? I think the most important of the stories, actually, is improvement in policies in developing countries. And I think that we have to go on working to support those improvements. And the returns do come. They need investment as well as the improved policies, and we have a role to play in bringing and encouraging that investment. But that, I think, is the big driver, and I do see that improvement in policies continuing. If you think of the kind of improvements we're looking for, you know, the change from 50 billion to 100 billion in aid would give you enormous returns in terms of health and education. Lastly on Brazil, I think that the early record of the Lula government has been tremendous, actually. They've shown the macro responsibility while really getting after some of the social problems. You don't bring a Gini coefficient of 0.6 down in no time. It's going to take a long time. But I think that education will be a very big part of the story. One of the reasons that Latin America inequality has gone up in this last decade or so has been a shift in demand towards more skilled labor and a change in the relative price of skilled and unskilled labor. The only answer to that is to try to get the labor more skilled. You don't want to de-skill the skilled labor, you want to skill the unskilled labor. So I think the education and training part of the story is very big. I also think that transfers have a lot to do with it. And when we actually, four or five of us went down to Brazil to talk to President Lula and the cabinet about 3 months ago, and we talked about some of the transfer policies, and I think they do well with the kind of progressive program that Mexico pioneered, where the transfers are mostly to the mother and mostly linked to attendance of the children at school and to attendance of the children at health clinics. And that kind of things work very well, using smart card technology, actually, to carry the information. It's worked well in Mexico. I think it could work well in Brazil. So it's a combination of education, as it were, and these kind of transfer payments. And I think the Lula government is moving very well on those fronts.
Thank you. I mean, Patricia, I think Tony Blair's quite right. We want to pull the Americans back into multilateral system rather than setting up an independent pole of power as some other countries in the world want to do. But can you say briefly how you would see that happening?
Yeah, Tony, let me respond to that. I mean, after 11th of September, it was very well recognized in Washington that if we were going to create, and if they were going to create, an international coalition against terrorism, then you had to create an international coalition for economic development and prosperity. And you really can't have the one without the other. And that understanding, I think, is still there, at least in parts of the administration, even if we haven't heard it quite as strongly as we did in the immediate aftermath of the 11th of September. But I also think, if you look at what the United States is actually doing, and if you look at their real interests in the security, in international security, what you find is they cannot solely rely on unilateralism. And it's a caricature of the American position to pretend that that's what they're doing. They absolutely rely on multilateral action to deal with the financing of terrorism and money laundering. And there's been a lot of work on that. They absolutely rely on international cooperation to get intelligence about terrorism and other threats to security. They, and we, rely upon and have helped to rebuild multilateral consensus within the Security Council in order to proceed with the rebuilding and reconstruction of Iraq following the conflict there. And I think the strongest argument that we can make to the United States is that their geopolitical interests actually depend upon a multilateral approach that is not confined to security issues, but is absolutely about building these economic coalitions and this new world trading system. I would also make the point that the consequences of allowing Cancun to fail, allowing the Doha Development Round to fail, are horrible, particularly for the developing countries, but also, actually, for the rest of us, at a time when the world economy desperately needs the boost to confidence that progress on the development round would actually bring. Beyond that, I think if we do allow the development round to fail, you know, and that is the alternative to making progress at Cancun, then actually what we can see is the unraveling of the rules-based system that we have so laboriously constructed with the World Trade Organization. We can see the world falling back into warring regional trade blocks, which will not be good for the growth of the developed world, but will be absolutely disastrous for the developing world. And I think Nick's point is absolutely right, that the governments around the world, I mean, not only our government, were absolutely empowered and strengthened on the debt relief agenda by Jubilee 2000. We have in Britain a pretty strong trade justice movement, and we'll be seeing more of that this week. And I think we need the faith groups and the NGOs who are the backbone of the trade justice movement really extending their reach, as they are starting to do, and making alliances certainly on the European continent, but also in the United States, I think particularly with the faith groups there, to try and start building the kind of public understanding about these issues and about the connection between peace and security on the one hand and economic prosperity and trade and development on the other, that we have begun to see with the emergence of the trade justice movement here.
Want me to say something?
Well, we go to the audience. Can you open this up?
Questions from the audience? Yes, ma'am.
There should be roving mics, I would stress, on both levels. Please, will people use the roving mic? Would they stand when they ask a question? Could their question be short? And could they also maybe say who they are briefly?
My name is Antoinette Valsamakis, and my question relates to the role of global civil society in the development agenda, and I ask this question particularly in the light of recent revelations of, again, unfortunately, President Bush's government asking that NGOs involved in humanitarian aid do not speak directly with the press, but clear their declarations through Washington in some form or another. And I'm just wondering whether any of the panel have a view on the role there of global civil society.
Well, I'm just wondering, I just saw a headline in a newspaper today, and it looked as if it was general, but this must be linked to the Iraq situation, or more specific, or you are, yeah. And so if it is a general statement, it's obviously impossible to understand. And even in the Iraq situation, I think it's not possible because of the whole tradition of civil society, and certainly after, you know, a war. When a war is on, NGOs in a certain way respect certain rules of that situation. But after that, I just don't think it's realistic. And so to me, it was a surprise to see that that suggestion was made. But while I'm answering, I have one thing on my mind, because several of you were discussing here. Why is it, and Paul Volcker, you were referring to it, why is it that the 0.5% in development aid of the 1960s has gone down to below 0.2? And why is it at the same time that the thinking, which has been around since, I remember my father telling me when I was a young child how important and absolutely essential it was that developing countries were given access to the rich country markets. Mm-hmm. It was the only way that the challenge of the world and the poor countries moving into another stage of development could happen. Now, so we've known this for 50 years at least. But what I have on my mind is that I seem to have sensed over these years that in the public debate, inside countries and between countries, the discussion about aid or trade, as if it was a question of either one or the other, has in a way made it possible for people to hide behind a kind of intellectual debate about whether aid works, whether the solution is trade, and you know, you put a lot of energy into that discussion while the trade is not opening up and the aid is going even down. So there is some kind of bind, and I think we have to address that issue and put people to the test that you need both financing of development and aid, and you need open trade and a change in the rules of global trade. There's no question. So those people who try to make it either or try to say that aid doesn't work are fundamentally, I think now, they are mistaken. And we should stop that kind of debate in a way, because it is just hiding. Hiding because it's hard to find money for something that is not for your next internal election. That's why.
Yes. David, I'm sorry.
Well, just a couple of things. I mean, I do agree greatly with what has been said on this panel, and that is worrying in the interests of liveliness. But I'd like to just pick up one point that you just made about global civil society. I think this a strong, robust, independent global civil society is clearly crucial for raising issues in the global agenda, which have often been neglected. You think of the balance of relationship between political regulation on the one side and market liberalization on the other. In the 80s and 90s, it swung radically towards market liberalizing forces and the coalitions that were pursuing them, reinforced by the dominant international financial organizations. And I think it was the robust, independent, so-called anti-globalization movement in its various forms that did, by systematically lobbying around the world, create a new emergent global public opinion that sought to check the untrammeled nature of market liberalization with other considerations of social justice. And I think those movements are fundamental. That those movements are now slightly weakened post 9/11 and are potentially deliberately weakened by the issue you just referred to is obviously a source of great concern. But the powerful have never just made significant changes on their own. They generally need pressure. And the pressure of an independent, autonomous, emerging global civil society seems to me fundamental. The issue was raised earlier, and it's the other one I want to pick up on. To what extent is money, Paul, you raised, the key issue in development? I think much of the agenda that has been set out here isn't just about huge new investments. Many of the changes I set out that Groen and Patricia referred to can be brought off relatively modestly, with relatively modest investments. But I think in the long run, there's no reason to think you can run a global economy in ways that are radically different from a national economy. I mean, if a national economy just had ministries that were market-driving forces, like the IMF and so on, they would create great lopsided imbalances within nation states. The trouble is, at the level of the international organizations we have today, we've created the great market-driving IGOs, but we've not complemented them with IGOs with teeth, concerned with poverty reduction, welfare, environmental issues, and so on. So there's a huge global imbalance in rule-making capacity. Now, what will we do about it? Well, it seems to me in the long run, we have to find ways of financing global governance differently. It can't simply depend, just as national governments can't depend simply on the charitable donations, why should we think that global governments should depend on the goodwill of powerful donors? You can't run a country like that. Why do we think you can run a global economy like that? The question then is, though, how to shift values. And that's partly a question about the role of the US today, but not just the US, because it's about fundamentally the role of Europe as well. The common market agricultural policy is a key culprit in all of this as well. But it's also about shifting our ethical and value orientations, and that is a very difficult thing. Just to give you one example of how difficult it is, but it highlights the depth of the vulnerability of politicians to consumers. And it's the UN budget is $1.2 billion. Plus peacekeeping and peacemaking. And someone asked me the other day at UCLA, isn't that an extraordinary sum of money? And I pointed out the UCLA budget is three times that, or nearly three times that, just the UCLA budget. The US confectionery budget of private consumption, confectionery is $27 billion. Alcohol is $70 billion, and cars is $600 billion. We need to think, and politicians, and this is a huge challenge for education, culture, and civil society, how a pattern of consumption has been set and institutionally developed over time, which does perpetuate the gulf between the life conditions of the richest and poorest. And I think unless we address that honestly and systematically, we'll not recognize that the rich will have to give way in some respects.
I must confess, Professor Haldeman, you said we can't run national policy on the basis of relying upon generous donors. The United States is making a fair try at just that policy. I even think the English are in terms of university support. Isn't that correct?
It's a moot point. You know. You ought to have someone from upstairs.
Can you take the mic, please?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm somewhat surprised that on a topic like this, the word corruption has not come from any of the panelists. I was going to correct and incorporate that. You mentioned it once in passing. So I got two questions. One, does the panel think it is an important issue or not? And two, I'd like to ask the two professors if they have any statistical evidence on the correlation between economic progress and corruption in various parts of the world. Thank you.
The evidence that weak governance, in which corruption is central, is damaging for growth is really pretty strong. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you compare countries with, according to whatever index of quality of governance or corruption that you use, and relate that to growth rates, you get a strong negative relationship. So the answer is that it does matter. It's central. It's also the case that one can do quite a lot about it. If there's no leadership from the top, and there are many countries where there's no leadership from the top, then it's actually rather difficult to do anything about it. But if there's some leadership from the top, you can do quite a lot. Transparency is very important. As Justice Brandeis said, sunshine is a great disinfectant. And if you start publishing things, it makes a big difference. Let me give you just one example from Uganda. We found in one of our public expenditure reviews that 13% of the money which left the finance ministry for the non-salary payments in schools was arriving and being spent at schools. So with the collaboration of the finance ministry, we promoted a scheme whereby the money that left was put out in local newspapers, and the money that was supposed to show up was nailed on the door of the schools, and it was compared with the money that actually did show up. That 13% changed to close to 90% within 2 or 3 years. You didn't have to take anybody to jail, you just published it. And transparency is very powerful, and I think it's very important that that is pushed. Corruption goes up with the number of levers you give people to be corrupt on. So all kinds of quantitative controls and licensing are part of the whole corruption story. It's been very powerful in India under the Permit Raj and so on. So that's the second thing you can do. And the third is reform, civil service reform. There's quite a lot you can do in terms of training and structures and promotion on merit and so on. So actually quite a lot of practical things you can do. You don't have to sort of throw up your hands and say it's all impossible. But you do need some leadership from the top, and if that's not there, then that can effectively be blocked.
China has had a problem with corruption. So has the United States.
I take this question. I have to say that anti-corruption is vital factors, one of the vital factors in the development of any economy. And the Chinese government attaches great importance to this aspect. And in this connection, we have taken several measures. First, I think we have to streamline the government. And in China, we call it dismantle the temples and reduce the number of monks. Because if you have too many monks in the temples, they're always trying to get something to eat and something to exploit. So if you want to reduce corruption, you have to get rid of too many officials. And so the streamlined government agencies is very important. And secondly, I think you have to reduce those kind of items subject to administrative approval. Because any items for subject to administrative approval may become a root cause of some kind of corruption. So in the last 2 years alone, our government has abolished 792 items subject to administrative approval. And that reduced a lot of possibilities of being corrupted. And thirdly, of course, as the professor said, that transparency is very important. Because if you do not practice transparency, the corruption does happen. So we are dealing with this matter very seriously. Of course, in addition to that, you have to punish in a very severe way those corrupted officials. Because if you do not punish them, the others will follow. Thank you.
I think it's fair to say the World Bank itself has helped raise this corruption issue into much more prominence in the world debate. Let's go to the gallery up right in the middle.
My name's John Rowland, and I'm a second-year government student here. This is a question about the context in which development takes place, and I'm going to pose it in the style of a GV223 exam question. Liberal democracy is the best political context in which to pursue development for developing countries. Discuss.
The question was, liberal democracy is the best political context in which to pursue development. Let me, whilst the rest of the panel is thinking, give one shot. I think if you look at the relationship in practice, it's actually quite hard to find one. You can find dictatorial countries like Singapore or Hong Kong pre-97 and whatever you think after 97. Has those countries grew pretty rapidly. So if whichever corner you look, you know, of the, you know, the four-way classification that you can get sort of for growth and with and without liberal democracy, you can find examples. You can play the game of correlations, but frankly, in this particular area, I don't think it tells you very much. You can look at the reasons why liberal democracy might come out with stronger results, and you can look at the reasons why more dictatorial regimes might come out with strong results. And again, you can pursue those. Liberal democracies are likely to be more transparent, so for the reason that we're discussing, they would be better that way. More different kinds of regimes can sometimes make it easier to take the tough decisions and to stay with them. So my own view is that we should be cautious about insisting that there is a big relationship between liberal democracy and economic growth. The arguments in favor of liberal democracy are deep and fundamental, having to do with basic liberty, human rights, and so on. And I think they're powerful, indeed overwhelming arguments. And you don't have to introduce the economic ones to get to the conclusion. It's a lot more attractive than the alternatives.
So your other comments on
I was just keep them brief because
I'm going to be short. It's just that as we talk about economic development, I'm sure that Nick Stern is right in what he says. The question is, if you add other dimensions, which is what you said, value-based, but sustainable development, I don't think can happen without democracy. So just to be brief, that's what I think.
Great question, you failed. Excellent question. I broadly agree. I'm a passionate advocate of democracy and democratization, and I believe that the values and rights that underpin it, and the senses of duty that underpin it, are fundamental for the recognition of the dignity and equal moral worth of every human being. But I think you cannot simply be a democratic dogmatist. It's very clear that some countries in the world have successfully developed without initially having a commitment to democracy. It's very clear that most Western countries developed first as liberal polities before they democratized as liberal democratic polities. And if you take countries as big as Russia and China today and compare them, I don't think you could possibly conclude that a dogmatic democracy is the best of all possible policy prescriptions for development purposes.
There's an interesting book that just came out recently in the United States by Fareed Zakaria. I don't remember the name of the book, but the emphasis of the book is let's be careful about putting too much emphasis on democracy alone too quick. That what's important is you have a liberal society and you have protections of personal freedoms, of freedom of speech, of press, protections against arbitrary actions, and all the kind of things that, in fact, developed in many Western countries before democracy did. Exactly. And democracy will come in good time, but these other things are sometimes some democratic governments have, and particularly in the emerging world, have not been favorable towards some of these basic elements of a liberal society. And we ought not forget about that priority.
Yeah, I was just going to say there's another interesting book called World on Fire, which links, as it were, ineffective democratic mechanisms with the rise of ethnically based religious groups which can dominate a society and which can lead to kind of fundamentalist government. So there's a big debate about that.
Nothing's easy. The second row, we'll take the second row here, the young woman.
Can I ask everyone from the top to speak up? And maybe you'd stand up as well, because it's easier for people to hear downstairs.
It's high up here. My name is Bianca Zakrzewski, and I'm a general course student, and I did not vote for Bush. my question is, the CNN effect describes a phenomenon where after a time of crisis or conflict, there is an upsurge in public aid and development work in a region, in that crisis equals funding. What is the best way a developed country can increase public awareness and funding before a conflict to kind of reverse this trend?
Patricia, do you want to?
Well, what that suggests to me is that you cannot rely, and developing countries can't rely for significant funding on the upsurge that comes in response to the crisis and the CNN coverage, the international coverage. And governments themselves have to make the commitment to increasing their aid budgets and spending those aid budgets wisely. Now, we are, despite what Gro was saying about the general problem of increasing spending on foreign aid, we actually are increasing our aid budget. we're also working rather hard with our European partners to try and increase the effectiveness of Europe's, the aid budgets that go through the European Union, which we don't regard as a model of effective expenditure. I don't know what Nick thinks, but we're certainly not very keen on it. I just think, the truth is that the funding that goes to developing countries from the emergency appeals, although it is significant and can do a great deal of good, is dwarfed by the aid budgets. And those, in turn, are not nearly as big as they ought to be. And I completely agree with what Gro was saying earlier about this is not a choice between aid and trade. You have to do both. And increasingly, trade-related aid is where you're going to need to be putting your aid budgets as well.
Got one more. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Yasna Singh, and I'm an MSc student here. My question is for Nick Stern. I was wondering if the World Bank anytime soon might plan to pack its bags and move to another address anywhere else in the world so that it actually represents the world.
When I was offered the job just over 3 years ago, I tried to get it to move to London. And as you can tell by my accent, this is a city which I have some association. But the reason I failed is it's in the charter of the World Bank that it has to be located in the country of the largest shareholder. And the United States has 16%, and it's bigger than any other. So it's in the original charter of the bank. It doesn't have to be in Washington. And I can think of other places. But it's just a constraint. But the spirit of the question I have comes very close to my heart.
Yes, sir.
Good evening. My name is David Bryden. We've been regaled and bludgeoned with statistics all evening long, $2 a cow, half a percent of global production. We have a hard enough time getting good quality statistics in developed economies and getting the right inferences from those. What challenges do you face in emerging economies, and how can you make a better use of the statistics which you generate?
I mean, we're the source of a large number of these statistics, and it is a big problem. I mean, we're quoting income distribution figures based on household surveys, which might be 10 or 15 years old. You're looking at literacy data, in countries that have had a population census, if they've had one at all, 15 or 20 years ago, and the quality isn't that great. There are two or three answers to that. One is to invest in the data, and I think that's extremely important. And that is, I think, one of the areas of priority for aid on the administrative side, is just to get better numbers so that the ordinary job of managing the economy, which is the response in the society, which is the responsibility, of course, of the poor country itself, is just easier to do because you've got better access to information. So I think the one answer is investment. A second answer is to be careful with your use of the numbers. And I think we could all do better in that. And what I'd like to see is more emphasis in publications on the quality of the numbers so that people are helped to understand them. So those are the kinds of things which I think we have to do. But meanwhile, we try to make the best use of what we've got. And as long as that's done responsibly, it's a lot better than giving up on the numbers altogether.
I do have to apologize, so dozens of people want to ask questions. We've only got about another 7 or 8 minutes, so we can't, I'm afraid, satisfy everybody. So I'll leave it to Paul to make his selection.
You won't let me tell my statistic story. Yes,
not him, because he asked this morning. You're
expecting this morning. Yes, let's ask Peter.
Now at least we know that win-win situation. Question is to WHO director. If it could eradicate malaria alone, tourism alone could revive the African economy. But
yes or no is the question.
The question to Chinese premier is that.
Thank you.
Corruption. Everybody, it's you, the Westerner. You are the corrupt. You are the corruptor. Who gets the money? Even we in India, we have been bribed by Swedish donors. But forget of corruption is everywhere.
Okay.
But the problem in our country is that intimidation. If I, there is no freedom of expression. Why do we all flee the country? If I talk something in China, I go to jail. In India, I go to mountain or desert. So make sure that, why do we flee? From fire to frying pan. So allow your own professional to try your own, but we will do a lot for our country than you, the corrupt politician.
Please, sir, would you stop? Because you had a chance to ask a question this morning.
It is not only corruption, it is intimidation.
Okay.
And here, you people talk. You talk only, okay, we'll give aid. Come on, let the WHO, World Bank Chairman is here, give them some empty checks so that we can pass it to the South Korea.
Please. No. He doesn't answer that question. Nobody.
Let us do something, okay?
Is that another question?
Well, there was Peter, do you want to ask a question? Please take the mic and identify yourself. Could the question be short, because we haven't got that much time left?
I didn't quite get whether I have an answer to what was said before. I don't have an answer to that, and I'm not intending to do that. I was delighted, especially with Mr. Young, too, speaking about coming from a developing country and talking about the goodies of globalization, of for China having entered, and the representatives of institutions who deal directly or indirectly with development. They all seem to agree. In the first session in the afternoon, I was a little bit afraid that there was maybe another mood in the room, but it has changed. To confirm that, the EU has published a statistic saying that in the last 50 years, world output has increased by sixfold and population only by 2.5-fold. So it's very interesting to see, from what I hear today, is why is it such that these demonstrations against globalizations are basically carried on by, let's say, people from richer countries and not by the people from the really poor countries? Is it that those from the rich countries are afraid that they eventually face competition from poor countries, because trade, after all, is all about this? And therefore, I have a question to...
I've got a question to
Mrs. Hewitt.
We haven't got that much time.
Just a question to Mr. Hewitt. And the question is, what are the European governments going to do? We spend $40 billion, roughly, US dollars in subsidies for CAP. And the key is going to be the position of the European Union. So what is the chance that this is, in the next 100 days, will come to some sort of a more positive development than has been obviously come up in the last couple of days in Greece?
Thank you. Would someone like to answer that? Do you want to answer first?
Yes, a quick answer on that. All the member states, including the French, have accepted the central principle that we have got to decouple the support we give to farmers and rural communities from these subsidies that just encourage farmers to produce more and more stuff that then gets dumped at subsidized prices on world markets. And the outline compromise deal that's on the table, that's being discussed in the Agriculture Council again this week, where there is qualified majority voting, crucial to this process, does give us the chance. I'm cautiously optimistic that we will get an agreement this week that will then allow us to make a significantly improved offer through the World Trade Organization. It may still not be enough, and we are very much in the forefront of demanding change here, but I think what it reflects is the fact that while it may be difficult to agree increased funding for foreign aid budgets, it's even more difficult to agree a trade deal that risks putting your constituents out of work or your most powerful interests onto the streets, you know, as French farmers are wont to do. And that, I think, is the really big interest block that the developed countries, including the United States, have to overcome. But I think we will make progress. It won't be everything, but it'll be something in the Agriculture Council this week.
I think we'll just let the audience ponder the issue of globalization. Just take one final quick question from an LSE student. I'd like to take the last question. Could it be quick and to the point? If no one wishes to ask one, then that plan is... He says, can LSC students be quick and to the point? Yes, they can, and we'll see this happening now.
Great.
And speak loudly, please.
Rati Tripathi, just finished the MSc Economics last week from LSC.
The questions and the issues I wanted to raise have pretty much been covered, politics mixing with globalization. So the precise question I want to ask is to each member of the panel, could you give me the odds on France derailing the reforms of the EU CAP and on the Doha development round being failing, essentially? And, well, okay, I won't answer what next. I won't ask what next because there's no time.
Can I also ask one member of the panel to comment on that?
Well, how about, you know, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will? I mentioned qualified majority voting for the Agriculture Council. I believe we will do a deal there, and I believe we will make progress at Cancun, and therefore we will keep the development round on track. But it's going to be very, very hard work over the next 100 days and beyond.
Can I just say, we do have to draw to a close. Can I first of all apologise for the stuffy condition of the lecture room? The people who design air conditioned systems think the idea of a British summer is an oxymoron, so it can never cope when there is actually a sunny day. This has been a very, very good session. I do apologise to people who wanted to ask questions. Paul Volcker has been such a good friend to the LSE, chaired this morning's meeting, chaired this one. Would you please give him a special round of applause? Now, if you don't mind, a round of applause for our distinguished panel. Alan, have you got an announcement to make? You're poised there.
Yeah, thanks very much. Can I ask those of you who have a folder ticket who are joining us for dinner to make your way promptly to the Aldwych, where the coach is ready to take you to Bridgewater House. Please have your ticket ready to show when you board the coach. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, everybody.
So we're moving to another place.